Okay, I'd like to convene the Finance Committee. We do have a quorum present. Representative Solberg has been paying close attention to the minutes, and I think would like to make a motion. Representative Solberg moves your approval. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. The first bill this morning is House File 1242 by Representative Seifert, known as Brandon's Law. And is Representative Seifert here?
Oh.
Representative Seifert, if you could come forward and give a brief explanation of the bill. At this point, there is no fiscal impact, as I understand it, relative to the state budget. We also have Dale and Sally Zamlin, the parents of Dan Zamlin, who have requested to testify. And so their comments will be relatively brief, but by way of a quick background, they're the parents of the son who has disappeared. And normally, as all of you know, when a bill is reported out of division, the testimony on the various bills takes place in division, but we have a unique situation here with the disappearance of the son just happening very recently, and so we're making an exception and would like you to make a few comments here this morning. And I would say welcome. We do have a couple of procedural motions, however, that we have to take care of first. Representative Tamar?
Mr. Chair, I would move the Public Safety Division report for House File 1242 to the First Committee in Brooks.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Tamar?
And then I would move that House File 1242 to the First Committee in Brooks since we recommended to pass and place on the general register.
Okay, that motion is before us. And if you could, Representative Seifert, just give a brief overview of Brandon's Law, and then we'll have the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, this bill is about adults who go missing under dangerous circumstances. It makes changes in laws that will make big changes for anguished family members who are particularly missing adult children. The changes, Mr. Chair, real briefly, will require police departments to take reports on persons missing under dangerous circumstances without delay, which and I have the short version of the bill here, Mr. Chair, but essentially there are circumstances that are laid out where without delay, and law enforcement worked with us on the bill to get the wrinkles out of the bill, working with the Sheriff's Association and the Police Association. Representative Tamar, I want to thank publicly for working with us on getting the language to the comfort level for all of those involved. It also defines the types of endangered persons for whom law enforcement should launch to get a search going as soon as possible under professional judgment in the circumstances outlined in this bill. It will encourage police departments to seek warrants for cell phones and other electronic devices as soon as possible. And in situations, Mr. Chairman, this is a legislation that has already gone through in 10 states and updating these statutes for the 21st century, where when we first worked on things like this in the 1960s and 70s, we didn't have things like cell phones. If you look on the back page of the bill, the reason we are moving this bill along quickly is we have situations where cell phones have pinging devices, and I've learned a lot about how these things work with this particular bill, but with the battery life on cell phones being rather brief at times, time is of the essence with taking missing persons reports. And so if we can get law enforcement on the case and expedite the warrants, we potentially can locate people by zone through cell phone devices. That is not in statute right now. Mr. Chair, we'll assemble a working group that will be paid for, and this is the only thing relating to a fiscal impact. The working group is laid out in Section 12, In working with the Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association, the Police and Peace Officers Association, and nonprofit foundations, to create policies on informing families and in getting development about searches and standardized reporting procedures. I would like to thank the Francis Foundation, the John Francis Foundation, for committing the dollars, knowing that we have a large deficit. We feel it'll be about $10,000 for this working group to be able to work, and they have agreed to pay for that, Mr. Chairman. So we have a certified fiscal note that the bill is zero. We have worked out the concerns law enforcement had and deleted those portions of the bill that members on both sides had in relating to unfunded mandates, and worked those situations out. Identical legislation, Mr. Chairman, is awaiting on the Senate floor. I have with me today, Mr. Chairman, the parents of Dan Zamlin, Dale and Sally, whom I met yesterday. The parents of Brandon Swanson came for the other committee hearings and are not with us today, but will be here for the House floor session. But I did want to give the Zamlins an opportunity briefly to testify, being that it is in a unique circumstance. And the bill, ironically, was going through while this was going on, but there are circumstances in the endangered category, which Dan fit into, that we want to make sure that if this happens again, that we certainly update our statutes to be able to react to these quickly. Mr. Chair, with that, I will turn the rostrum over to the parents of Dan Zamlin, Sally and Dale Zamlin, from the Iron Age.
Okay, welcome to the committee, and I'm not sure which of you wants to go first, but if you could just identify yourself for the record and begin your comments.
Zamlin, I'm Dan Zamlin's mother. I want everybody in this room, if you haven't read it in the paper, he's an exceptional person. He's an A student. He's a three-star athlete. He's an altar server. He's a catechism teacher. I can't say enough good things about him. I've never worried about him as far as going out or, you know, he's got a good head on his shoulders. And a year ago, we realized he was type 1 diabetic. And that was a concern to me, and having him come to the University of St. Thomas was very comforting because it was like a home away from home. And he runs the Mississippi Boulevard. He runs 10 miles a day. He runs to the Ford plant. He runs to the U of M. He runs to the Capitol. He's in very good physical condition. And he's also a brainiac as far as high tech, and I want this, and it has to be the best and the most updated. He has an iPhone. And the first thing we ran into was when we got the call and we were down here, and yes, we were speeding, was that you can't go down that bluff, it's too dangerous, and it's like, well, if I can't, then you have to, and they refused. Okay, so there was no, in fact, the first 5 hours we were there, there were no police there. There was a lot of cameras there, but there was no police there, because he's 18, and maybe he wanted his 24 hours of alone time. Well, what they don't care about is that he was talking to somebody on the phone, and just, you know, I have no proof of this, but his last words were, oh God, oh God. And so that, you know, like something startled him. So they're telling me he's in a place where it's too dangerous to go down, and these are his last words that were spoken, and the police are saying he wants his alone time. So, okay, so now I'm concerned about him falling down there, and nobody's willing to go down there. And he wears an Omnipod insulin pump, which is about a 3-day supply of baseline insulin. And nobody really knows when he changed that, so nobody really knows what he had on him. And they're like, well, okay, you know, it's Sunday afternoon, we'll get right on it. And then at one point in the afternoon, one policeman came and to make sure nobody would go down the block. Not to look for him, but to make sure nobody else would go down there. And then there was a mention of, well, we're going to put boats in. And 2 hours later, a reporter asked where the boats were, and they said, well, we can't do it today. because of the how high the water was. Okay, I can understand that. They did do a flyover with infrared looking for him. And then every day it was, well, tomorrow we'll do it. Tomorrow we'll try again. Tomorrow we'll try again. And in the meantime, I had to call Senator Tomassoni to see what I could do, what he could do for me to expedite the AT&T iPhone is under my name. It's on my account. And I was told that because he's 18, I needed some type of court order to get access to his information. So here I am paying the bill, thinking I'm doing my kid a favor by giving him this phone, and I'm told that I have no access to that because he's 18. So we have to get this piece of paper, whatever it was, before they would even, and then go through hoops. A friend of mine and I sat at the police department for about 5 hours on Tuesday morning trying to get this process done where the police could get the saved messages off his phone and define the GPS of where that phone was located. And in that particular spot, there's a tower for Minneapolis and a tower for St. Paul, and they bounce off of each other because there's a dead zone there. So then at that point, that was the very first time that we talked to any missing persons people. That was Tuesday. This is Tuesday morning. Now, he went missing at 3 o'clock on Sunday morning. So we're talking to them, and we're trying to tell them and tell them and tell them, and they're focusing on the river. And I appreciate what they're doing there, and I know they're the ones with the expertise and the equipment to be down there, but there's other things that possibly could have gone on. And it wasn't until Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday when they finally brought bloodhounds out and actually defined where he was. They had 8 dogs, and they all went, just walked the same path and stopped in the same place. And you know, they should have been out there Sunday afternoon. They should have been out there Sunday afternoon. And then Danny Williams, the missing persons investigator, we talked to him on Saturday, and he said, we're doing everything we can, but there's no overtime. And it's like, but we're here for you 24/7. It's, you know, just not on weekends. There's no overtime. I said, I will pay you your overtime. I will do that. I will mortgage my house. I will go in debt for the rest of my life. Just provide the resources to do this. There's other people coming in from all around the state saying, we're willing to help you. We can do this. We have this kind of equipment to bring in. And the police department is saying, no, this is our investigation. We don't want them tampering with our evidence. And it's all about, you know, my son didn't get to take the weekend off. My son didn't get to come home for Easter. And maybe if there had been some overtime funds available, or maybe if there was the possibility of extra manpower, there could be people on the river doing what they do best down there, and there could be people looking in other directions. I mean, we are seriously running out of time. You know, if he was not diabetic, I would say, well, you know, people can go a long time without eating, you know, and maybe he had some kind of shelter. Maybe he's not out in the cold when it's 28 degrees out at night, you know. But we're running out of time, and money can't be the reason why we can't get to him in time. It can't be. That's not a good enough excuse. Okay.
Suzanne, did you want to comment?
Yes,
well,
yes, I've got some other things to add. One of the other things you need to know is Dan is an Eagle Scout. I spent a lot of time with him from northern Minnesota. If Dan slipped and fell in that area, there'd be marks. We walked that riverbank up and down. I work in an open pit mine. I can climb anything. I worked in there all my life up there. One of the points I'm going to make to you is, Dan was missing about 12 hours before anything was really, really getting in motion. This iPhone 10 cracks of GPS. The phone went dead at 8:30 in the morning. Dan went missing at 2:30. All of his friends were down there and reported this. We were on the phone talking to these people at 8:30 in the morning. It was already too late. If somebody would have taken the initiative to try to find that phone, this young fellow, he's a child yet. Look at what goes on for insurance from work, up to 21, in some cases 25. These kids are fairly naive to the area. They're not from the area. They come into your area, and these are the kind of things that happen to these young men and young ladies, and it will continue to keep happening. And if you do not spend the time to use the resources that are there to locate these people, sometimes you're going to be wrong, but in this case, it wouldn't have been. They would have had an idea where he was at. We still don't have an idea. We still don't have those records. We want the records to try to locate where that phone is at, key piece of evidence to find out where he's at. I don't believe he's in the river. We've looked that thing up and down. They've been in there with side scanning sonar. They've been in there with this. They were down there. They tried to lead the dogs to the river. Dan's not down there, but he vanished from that area along that river. I think it's an abduction. And I honestly think if they would have had the right to go after that phone, you got a kid that's in danger here. He's a type 1 diabetic, tougher than nails. He's got a heart rate of a marathon runner because he does run. That's the good thing he's got going in his corner. And, you know, these people that have the opportunity to go out and look and use these resources, their hands are tied. And they did the right things. They followed the letter of the law. They're good people. They're doing the right things. They're making all the right efforts they can. But I'll tell you one thing in closing here is I understand I'm a vet. I understand why missing people, we pick them up in other countries for those parents. You know why? Because nobody else is going to. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Representative Seifert, you referenced in your presentation the cell phone issue, and it appears then that, at least as the spill moves forward, that that's an attempt to correct the problem that the Zamlins encountered with their son. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, there is an urgency. In Section 14, we put consideration for tracking of electronic devices. I would also note that it's also an awareness campaign. I didn't even know what the word ping on a cell phone meant until I got involved in this legislation. And for people who buy cell phones for their children, like the Zamlins, literally paid for the iPhone, they have a pinging device in Dan's phone. And for those of us, most of us are parents around this table as lawmakers, to get awareness out there that not all cell phones have pinging devices inside of them, and that if you have a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old and they're getting a cell phone, to get that awareness out there that this is, that when they're going off to college or high school, this is a resource that we should take advantage of through GPS, and that the timing is the essence. And we worked with law enforcement getting the wording just right on accepting the report without delay. But a lot of these folks don't know the resources. They don't know there's a Civil Air Patrol until you're thrust into a situation like this. And we tried to list out the situations. We've worked with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I also, Mr. Chair, would point out that the section relating to DNA samples in Section 4, BCA testified, would be absorbed internally. And they have done a remarkably better job in recent years of being able to track DNA in terms of missing persons cases. We have hundreds and hundreds of missing person adult cases in Minnesota, and I think this legislation will go a long way in helping, and in a bipartisan way we can address this. The number one job of us is to protect public safety. It makes sense, and we're hopeful we can move the legislation forward quickly.
Okay, any discussion on the bill or questions of the Zamlins over here? Well, thank you very much, and we wish you the very best in your search, and thank you for being here this morning. I think you pointed it out clearly, the need, and reinforced the author's position on the Brandon bill, and so we appreciate your comments.
Thank you. One more item. I understand missing children now, and missing persons, and the people like the John Francis Foundation, the Jacob Wetterling Foundation. They come to your site right away. They get you around all of the bushes and the pitfalls and everything like that, and lead you right to the chase, you know. Law enforcement did as well as they could. Their hands are tied. They need. It doesn't even cost any money to do this thing, and you'd want it for your own children, your own wife. It's available. Use it.
My thought is, you know what? You know, it was a hoax, and somebody really didn't want to be found, and then they are found, and you know what? Give me the bill for the 20 grand or the 50 grand that all the effort was put into to find this person who committed the hoax. That would be a lot cheaper than waiting 5 days to start. You know what? So, seriously, if somebody thinks somebody is missing, believe it. You have to believe that first. And if it turns out that they chose to be missing, then deal with that later. But the urgency is to find the person and let them tell you that they chose to be missing.
Your points are very well taken, and thank you. Any concluding comments from the author?
Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the time this morning and appreciate moving up to first in the agenda on behalf of the family so they can get back to work.
Well, thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you very much, and we'll now go to House File 1122 by Representative Junkie. Excuse me, 1657. Representative Tamar.
I'm not prepared at all.
Must have been my trifocal place. Get down the line. We'll get to you yet. Okay, Representative Tamar, would you move the committee report?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Public Safety Finance Division report for House File 1657, the first committee endorsement.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Tamar?
And then I'd move House File 1657, the first committee endorsement, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us, and if you could walk us through the bill and Representative Tamar.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to go through the spreadsheet very briefly, and with me is Gary Carger, fiscal analyst with the Public Safety Finance Division. And I don't know how much you want me to go into the bill in detail, but we'll start with the spreadsheet. And given the nature of the economy, we were asked to make a $52 million reduction in our budget, which was not an easy feat. And I just want to go through the spreadsheet, and you can see where our cuts are. For the biennium, we made a $505,000 reduction to the Supreme Court, a $194,000 reduction to Civil Legal Services, a $165,000 reduction to the Court of Appeals, and $3,996,000 to the District Court. We asked everyone within our division to make a small cut, so that's why you'll see these relatively small ones to the Tax Court, the Uniform Laws Commission, and the Board of Judicial Standards. We reduced the biennial appropriation to the Public Defense Board by $3,400,000.
Under public safety, you will see this is just a move. This is part of a surcharge that currently has a cash balance, and there's sufficient money in this account for training firefighters. So we're moving this amount of money from that special revenue fund for the hazmat team. And I believe there's was about $2 million of excess money there, so that shows up on the spreadsheet. On page 3 of the spreadsheet, here this is a transfer. It's a savings to the general fund and this to the trunk, and it's a reduction in the trunk. The DWI lab testing program is moved from the general fund to the trunk highway fund. And this was in the governor's recommendation. There's a total of $1,900,000 reduction to the BCA, and there's language in the bill that encourages the Department of Public Safety to apply for burn grants, and that can hopefully fund CRIMNAS and BCA scientists. There's no reduction in the fire marshal budget, a small reduction in the gambling and alcohol enforcement. There's a $1,938,000 reduction to the Office of Justice program. This could be, these programs are like the gang strike force, battered women's shelters, sexual assault programs, crime victim programs, youth intervention programs, etc. And I'll speak more to this when I get into the bill. The sections 116 through 129 on the spreadsheet all deal with the 911 emergency armor system. We made a slight reduction to the peace officers board. There's some reduction, $300,000 to grant the cities to train law enforcement officers. A small reduction in the private detective board. A 3% reduction to the Department of Human Rights. To corrections, you will see we did not accept some of the governor's recommendations relative to the pension plan and the changes to the dental services at our institutions. We did, and I'll speak more about this afterwards, we did agree with the governor and we terminated the short-term offender program, which will help many of your counties that have been struggling as we've not sufficiently paid the per diem cost for jail for those inmates who are housed in county jails. We asked for a 1% reduction in per diem for offenders in our institutions and are asking the Department of Corrections to meet that goal. You'll see a dollar reduction here, and then you'll see the money is back there again on lines 161 and 162, and this is federal stabilization funding from the federal government. And some corrections that you should know about. And then sentencing guidelines, we made a small reduction. And you will see at the bottom of the spreadsheet that we have raised for the biennium $29 million in fees. This was not something that we relished doing, but it was an opportunity for us to defray some of the cuts that would have been made to public safety, and we did not want to do that. So let me just put that in a little perspective here relative to the governor's budget request. The total reduction to the courts, as you probably know, Chief Justice Magnuson and the courts have been railing against the legislature and the governor for many months now about that they cannot sustain continued cuts, and we tried to be sensitive to that. So when we raised the fees, we earmarked those fees to the court, and where the governor had a 2.46 reduction, our reduction to the courts is 0.79. Still does not totally get the courts out of the hole that they're in, but I think it's between this and some of the other things that we've done to help them help them automate their services and some of the federal money that might be available to them. We think that the courts will be in much better shape. We did not cut the Board of Public Defense as much as the governor did. He had a 5% cut. We have a 0.96% cut. You probably heard from some of your public defenders or your courts during the last biennial session, they had to reduce public defenders by 50, and that is a drag on the court system, and we do not believe that we can continue having those kinds of reductions. The governor had a 10% cut to the Human Rights Department. We thought that was too high, and we reduced their budget by 3%. And corrections, although it's certainly our largest department within our division, in actuality, the reduction is less than 1%. So that's the spreadsheet. If you would like, Mr. Chair, I could quickly walk you through the bill and highlight the aspects that have that relate to finances, or I...
That's up to you, Representative Tamer. What you feel is important for the committee to know, or whenever you're ready, we can go to questions.
Maybe I'll just fly through it real quickly, just because some of it relates to the spreadsheet. If that's okay. So, on page 2 of the bill, we're requesting that the Chief Justice continue to evaluate and examine criminal justice deficiencies and costs and savings. They've been doing a lot of work on that over the last 2 years. We're asking that the court apply for federal stimulus money to continue drug court programs. We have about 33 in Minnesota. We'd like to see that expanded, or if any of them are cut, we'd certainly like to see the federal money be used to supplant those reductions. This technological improvement will save the court millions of dollars, and that makes up the bulk of Article 2 of the bill. We've asked the court to exercise caution in filling vacancies because of the budget deficit that we're facing, and that's reflected in D of subdivision D. And on page 5, we have done this with all of the departments under our division. We have stated that general fund appropriations cannot be used to pay the cost of lobbyists. I think it was the general feeling of committee members in our committee that we had enough commissioners and assistant commissioners that were at our meetings, that we didn't need to have lobbyists there, and this is a way of saving money. We asked the Department of Public Safety to reduce their car fleet by 20% in the metropolitan area. We have a provision on forensic scientists on page 6 that when they're planning and budgeting, that they include in their discussion the growth of regional labs and city labs when they come to the legislature requesting an increased scientist. The DWI lab analysis is the governor's recommendation. On page 7 of the bill, we are asking the Office of Justice Programs to submit a report to the committee detailing how they're setting up their competitive grant process. And we've also asked the Office of Justice Programs to consider funding, but not mandating, but we're asking them to consider funding trafficking victim programs, nonprofit organizations that work with friends and families of persons who have died traumatically, organizations that provide mentoring grants for children of incarcerated parents, youth intervention programs, a program to increase juvenile detention alternatives, reentry programs for offenders leaving prisons, restorative justice programs, and efficiencies to the judicial branch, including e-citation. We've also asked the Office of Justice Programs to not reduce funding to crime victim programs, sexual assault programs, battered women's shelters, and youth intervention programs by more than 3%. Subdivision 7, and for several pages, for the next couple pages of the bill, all deal with the 911 armor improvements that are expanding into greater Minnesota. We have similar language for the post board regarding agency lobbyists, also employees of the governor, that they should be in the governor's budget and not spread out through the departments under our division. And we've asked the Department of Corrections to reduce their car fleet by 20%. We're also asking the Department of Corrections to look at treatment alternatives and look at best practices for the offenders that are in our prison. To the extent possible, the report should identify options that will reduce the cost of treatment, expand the number of beds, improve treatment outcomes, and lower the rate of substance abuse relapse. We're asking the DOC to expand the CIP program, and this could also reduce beds. We asked for a per diem reduction, as I said earlier when I was going through the spreadsheet, and this is the 1% we're asking the reduction for. And we listed a number of ways. If you look on lines 14 through 15.3, ways that the DOC can reduce their per diem rate. And important to remember, on page 15 of the bill, if the commissioner fails to reduce the per diem rate by 1%, the commissioner must reduce funding for operation support, which is the central office, by the amount of the unrealized savings. On page 14, another point of this reduction is if the commissioner, on line 14.31, the commissioner must not eliminate correctional officer positions or implement any other measure that will jeopardize public safety to achieve the mandated cost savings. On page 16 is the gradual phase out of the short-term offender program, and then, as I said earlier, on Article 2, most of this deals with the improvements to the court's automated system to collect court fees. We found out from the court that they had about over $165 million in uncollected fees and restitution payments, and this automation, we think, will help them recapture some of that money. There's also cleanup language in Article 2, and it provides a process for dollars going to local units of government. The other sections that the committee may be interested in is in Article 2, is the increases in court fees, and the attorney registration fees and the public defender copay, and a bill by Representative Smith dealing with interest rate judgments. And in Article 3, we have an Eastland bill on offenders with controlled substances and the elimination of the short-term offender program. And then performance measurements were Hillstrom's bills dealing with the Department of Public Safety and Department of Corrections. And that, members, is the bill, and I stand for questions.
Okay. Are there any questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Tamar, as you and your committee members know, the judicial branch was basically saying that if the governor's cuts were implemented, there were certain categories of cases that they would be forced to no longer hear. I think I'd heard, you know, implied consent maybe, or certain conciliation court cases. At least that was the talk, that they wouldn't be able to. Are you satisfied that the level that you've reached here avoids that?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I know the courts are happy with the bill, I hope there's representatives here. There is. Ms. Marshall's here. I don't know if Mr. Saul's here. If you'd like to speak to them. They're fine with the bill.
Representative Simon.
I mean, do I think that there may be some additional reductions? I would hope not. I think that I think that we have adequately funded them given the trying times that we're facing.
Any further discussion? Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe just more of a comment or two than a question. First of all, I do want to acknowledge Representative Tamar and the work he did trying to pull this bill together, and I want to thank both him and you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Solberg. although I think had we been in charge, I would hope that we would have been able to come forward with a better target for Representative Paymar's committee than we have. I do acknowledge and recognize that given the dire situation that we're in, the $6.4 billion budget deficit, that all things considered, he was given a relatively good target. And I appreciate that as the lead Republican on the chair or on the committee. And Chairman Paymar has put together a bill that, while I don't support it, I think he's done a good job for the courts, Representative Simon. I think this is a big improvement over where we were. And I think there's. I just want members to be aware of a number of concerns I have with Representative Paymar's bill. And I think that had we been writing the bill on this side of the aisle, it would have been significantly different. I'm very concerned about the cuts proposed in the bill to corrections, Mr. Chair and members. I'm concerned about the impact that may have on our offender population, and more importantly, the safety of the safety of our guards and the institutions. I think there are some concerns. I know members on this side of the aisle have significant concerns about the size of the fee increases. There's nearly $25 million of fee increases in this bill. And while I appreciate Representative Paymar's attempt to use those to offset some of the cuts that otherwise would have happened to the courts, I think there's another way that this could have been done, and I would suggest should have been done. Mr. Chair, I'm going to urge members to vote no on the bill, but I do want to acknowledge the work done by Representative Paymar. I think I don't envy the position you're in. I think I know the bill would have looked different had we been in charge of the committee. I think you did your best, Representative Paymar. I'm not sure that your best is good enough, but we'll see. I know we're at stop one of a long road as we try to figure out how to get out of here. Hopefully by May 18th. So, Representative Paymar, thanks for your effort. Again, there are a number of concerns with the bill. I think that some of the priorities expressed in the bill could have been and would have been expressed differently if we had had an opportunity to write the bill. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just urge members to vote no.
Any further discussion? Representative Paymar, a concluding comment.
Mr. Chair, I just want to respond to one thing. I don't mind the criticism from Representative Cole. He's been great on the committee as the lead Republican. Has been fair with me, and we've had a good working relationship. And I the fees are a philosophical difference that we have. It was the best that we could do, and I have to say that it was something that the courts actually said that they could live with. And I have other information, too, that says, that the bar actually supported some of those fee increases if the money was dedicated to the courts. And we tried to do that in this bill. But I do take some exception to the comment that you believe that public safety or the safety of our guards will be in jeopardy with the cuts to the Department of Corrections. I want to reiterate that this is a billion-dollar bureaucracy, and these people are doing hard work for us. They're guarding some of the worst of the worst in our prisons, but we're asking them to make a less than a 1% cut. Less than a 1% cut. And I might add that their per diem rate in Minnesota is the third highest in the country. And that's comparing apples to apples. Third highest in the country. So we see companies and businesses all through the state of Minnesota laying people off by the hundred. If the Department of Corrections and can't find some efficiencies to reduce their budget by less than one half, 1%, they're something off. So I feel satisfied with the language that we have in our bill, that correctional officers cannot be eliminated by the language we have in the bill, that public safety will be ensured. With that, I appreciate your support.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 1657, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. We'll now go to House File 1122.
I didn't know how to turn the alarm off, so I just sort of set it for late enough. That usually doesn't bother me.
Taking the offer.
They have to actually read it.
Yeah.
I'm looking for Jim, though. I don't know where he's at. Tell him to come down here.
Representative Junkie, while you're getting organized.
I'm trying to round up my fiscal analyst. He's not in the room, so I'm not sure where
okay.
he's off.
Well, I did want to remind members that to align with the Senate, we'll be doing the same thing we did with the energy bill the other day. We'll be taking the presentation on Representative Junkie's bill. We'll be taking, I think there's an author's amendment that fine-tuned some of the numbers. The intent would be then to have the discussion, and then when we meet later, we will fold this, or make adjustments, I shouldn't say fold this bill in, make adjustments to align with the Senate. So the bill will be laid over in the same way that the energy bill was, but the idea is that this is our work session on the bill. And then we'll take it from there, and this is part of the conversation that Representative Keith and I had the other day. So, Representative Junkie, and I see you found your fiscal analyst.
Or he found me.
Or he found you, okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the Agricultural Economies Veterans Affairs Finance Division Report for House File 1122, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Then, Mr. Chair, I move House File 1122 before the committee, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us,
and then I understand
you'd like to get do the author's amendment to get the bill in the form that you'd like.
Mr. Chair, I move the A40 amendment.
Okay, if you want to just quickly comment on what the amendment is.
It's basically
doing.
Corrections, deletions, other things, correcting the bill as it went through. There's one more substantive part. It looks like it's bigger than it is. There's about three lines that are changed, but it takes about four pages to do it. And you see all the capital letters. It's based on the farmer lender mediation language that's in here, basically tying the University of Minnesota and the farmer lender mediation folks and the banks, the ag grape banks, and the other groups that are involved with this. One thing that's missing in farmer lender mediation notices is the amount of the debt that is being asked for in mediation. So we all agree that more information is helpful, and so we're just simply changing it that when you file a mediation notice, you also file the amount of the debt that you want mediated. And so it takes three or four pages to do that, but it's really a two or three line change.
Okay, the motion is before us then. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll briefly go over the fiscal sections of the bill and then certainly entertain any questions. I want to say thank you to the committee members. I think Representative Szymanski is the only member besides me that's on the committee, and I want to thank them for the work the last few months in putting this bill together. We think it's a very good product at the end of the day based on the targets and other things we were working with. Basically, our target for the next biennium is a decrease of 6%. The accounts we have in here are Agriculture, Board of Animal Health, Ag Utilization and Research Institute, and Department of Veterans Affairs. If we break that down, end of the day, in simpler terms, in those different areas, basically in Agriculture, we're $600,000. By the way, we have one of the smallest general fund budgets. We have a lot of fee-driven things in Department of Agriculture and other areas, but our general fund target is less than 1%. It's one of the smallest in the finance divisions. But given that in agriculture we were $600,000 below the forecasted base, however, we're above the governor's recommendations by about $1 million. So we feel good that we landed kind of in the middle of the base and the governor's recs, actually above the governor's recs in agriculture. Ethanol producer payments, which are a subsection of that division, took a 20% reduction. I should also mention as we go through this, our priorities in the committee was jobs and services. We wanted to make sure that we retained as many jobs as possible. We really didn't differentiate bureaucratic jobs in St. Paul versus field jobs. We just think it's a terrible time to be laying anyone off in this economy. It doesn't help at all. So we really focused on jobs and maintaining services, particularly in agriculture, services like our food safety laboratory that actually discovered the salmonella outbreak in peanut butter that you all are aware of the last 2 months. That was our laboratory that found that, and there's no cuts given to that division. Food inspectors, dairy inspectors, all the things that cover public safety, pesticide enforcement, all those are addressed in here, and all those jobs and those divisions should remain, and they should function fine. So we had some priorities in that. With that being the case, ethanol producer payments, which I think are very important and a commitment the state has made, were reduced 20% on the auspices that it's probably not hopefully going to create any job loss out there. And we still have the liability into the future for ethanol producer payments regardless of what we do. By statute, we have to continue to make deficiency payments until they're made whole. And so the plants know that they will get the money that the state has agreed to send them. There is, if we go to the Board of Animal Health, basically you see governor's recommendations followed to the dollar on that, and a reduction to the base of about $800,000. AURI, we disagreed with the governor. He wanted to cut about 50%. We cut about 7.5%, a little more than what we, if you did across-the-board cuts, but again, preserving a real important group out there with offices in Crookston, Morris, Marshall, and Waseca, and our value-added researchers and chemists and staff out there. So we thought that was important, and all the ag groups concurred. I got letters from almost every ag production group in the state asking not to reduce as much as was recommended in our original budget we were talking about as we reviewed the governor's. As we move to the Department of Veterans Affairs, if we look at veterans homes, we're actually $2.5 million above the forecasted base. So there's an increase of $2.5 million to veterans' homes. And on the Department of Veterans Affairs, if you look at their base services, there's a $928,000 increase, roughly $1 million above the base or the forecasted base. Now, the other area came out of Veterans Affairs that we had monies to deal with. And I'm going to explain it briefly. It's the same thing we did last year, members. For those of you that were on this committee or in the legislature, you all supported this and voted for this last year, except for Representative Biskins, who didn't vote for the bill anywhere because of the fees, and we appreciated your explanation. But most everyone else did. What happened a number of years ago, members, is we put together what's called the Minnesota GI Bill. The Minnesota GI Bill is a last dollar in higher ed tuition program. And so what happens is our veterans who qualify for veterans benefits for schooling will apply to the federal government, they'll apply to the schools, they'll apply for Pell Grants, they apply for scholarships, they apply for all the resources that are available out there. Once it's done, and at the end of the day, if there's still a gap in tuition, once they get all those other resources in and there's still a gap in tuition, then this last dollar Minnesota GI Bill kicks in. 2 years ago, we decided to, we looked at the federal government, and at that time they were not funding the GI Bill federally. And that became a concern of ours, and so we added about $6 million a year or $12 million a biennium to that program, anticipating we'd have to pick up a large share of their tuition payments. Well, what happened, thankfully, is last year the federal government came through and fully funded the federal GI Bill. And so what that did is basically, and you see it carried over in our basis now at $6 million a year, similar to last year when we did our supplemental finance bill. Tracking back to the folks that put out the grants, we've actually utilized less than $1 million a year in the first 2 years of that program. So what you can see by that is $6 million is probably $5 million in excess monies that are out there that will not be used, that will fall to the bottom line because they are earmarked for that program at this point. So rather than let that fall to the bottom line, we left about $1.5 million a year in that account, which we think is a cushion of about $500,000 a year in that account over historic levels of usage. And we do anticipate, by the way, that the current Washington group out there, President and Congress, will continue to fund the federal part of that. So we've got a cushion of about $1 million in the biennium that can be used, and certainly if we see that scoping differently in the next year, we'll obviously be back here for a supplemental, but historically we don't believe that to be true. So there was a reduction of about $9 million in that fund. Similar to ethanol, that fund and the ethanol producer payments, we believe, was a prudent way to make those investments and move money around in these accounts, basically not affecting any jobs or any services or any care or any grants, veterans grants or anything else, but rather to hold stable all those departments. So when you actually look into it, like I say, Veterans Homes, $2.5 million above base. Veterans Affairs, $1 million above base, so increases there. And but the decrease, main decrease, came in the GI Bill. With that, I will just briefly run through some of the fiscal areas in the bill that are reflected on the spreadsheet, and then answer questions, Mr. Chair. If you look at the bill, obviously, Department of Agriculture, and by the way, all the policy items are in here, the two. This is a combined policy fiscal bill. So Representative Tremba, all the work she did in her division and sent things either onto me or onto the floor show up back in here. For example, Representative Emmer, your horse bill is in here. That would have been a policy item that probably went to the floor, but it's showed up in this bill. So you'll see those items showing up as we go through. I will not go through the policy items unless you have specific questions, but I wanted to make you aware they're in here. And as we get to the floor, I'll certainly call on authors of bills to entertain questions if they arise on those sections. Again, in Department of Agriculture, page 3, you see some of the monies. A lot of these were governor's recs, but some were legislative initiatives. I won't differentiate, but the combination is there. There's $75,000 each year for wolf and elk control up in mainly northern Minnesota. You see that on the top of page 3. You see plant pest survey money added in the middle of page 3. Again, those are surveys around the state that track rust and aphids and other things in crops, and extremely important to our soybean and small grain people in the state. Minnesota Grown is given money to continue their work. Particularly, we hope to get more money, as you see $50,000 of that appropriation on the bottom of the page, to do more marketing and labeling in grocery stores and restaurants of Minnesota Grown products. Sustainable Ag grants were cut, but there are still $100,000 a year for that program, research, and they publish a book, actually. That's on page 4. Local training and assistance for livestock siting, bottom of page 4, is added. Integrated pest management monies, again, on top of the page added. Organic cost share was reduced by a lot. Reason being, we have federal funds, $388,000 a year now coming in to pick up organic cost share payments for licensing of organic farmers. So we reduced that amount substantially. We'll keep an eye on it, but we think for the next 5 years with the federal farm bill, that'll be covered. Down on the bottom is the ethanol money reduction. You see it went from roughly $15 to $12 million a year, a 20% decrease. Page 6, bottom, you see grants for farmers market. We had some hail and other things come through, mainly Twin City area truck farmers and farmers market folks who incurred damages. We've agreed to look at picking up some of their membership fees as they try and get back on their feet from storm damage last year. Dairy development grants, I think it's important to note there was a reduction of twice in the governor's bill, talking dairy producers and others. We still think it's an important program, so we reduced that reduction to about half of what was recommended. Northern Crops Institute money, that's for a partnership with North South Dakota, Minnesota on a campus in North Dakota, but we've been a member of that institute for a number of years. Livestock Breeders Grants, as you're going down, these are small. Ag Ed Leadership Council grants, county fairs. For all those that aren't aware, we pay for our county and our state fair people. All those little awards they get, the $2 and $3, and that the kids get for 4-H and other things at the fair, you all help pay for that, and that's reflected on the bottom of page 7. Again, Governor's Rex, and we concurred. Poultry grant, small on page 8. Turf Seed Council grant on page 8 is Northwest Minnesota Turf Seed. Bottom of page 8, $50,000 a year for Minnesota Turf Seed Council. That, again, goes to research mainly for cellulosic ethanol plant production, switchgrass, and other varieties that they're growing up north to discover what will work best for our next generation of ethanol fuels. The bottom of that page, again, important, I think, to note this time of year, $1 million is given in the biennium for food shelves, fresh milk at food shelves for the people that utilize that, and that fully funds fresh milk across the state for our food shelf clients. Livestock Investment Grant shows up on the bottom of page 9. That's a program started last year, as you know, to invest in improving and enhancing our livestock operations. Probably need $15 million a year, but we continue that program with $1 million. Mental health counseling, again, a very important piece that we do at some of our Minnesota colleges to identify farmers that may be in mental distress as our adult educators are out and working one-on-one with them. In the middle of page 10, $800,000 a year goes to the Fertilizer Research and Education Council, again, doing fertility research and education, mainly to reduce fertility rates and to do best practices. Then on the bottom page 10, you see Board of Animal Health. It's pretty straightforward. There's a small rider, but that was basically Governor's recommendations. AURI, again, you see on page 11, basic, about 7.5% decrease, not much rider language, but certainly some policy bills associated to it. Then for the fiscal part, we jump kind of to the back of the bill. If you go to page 60, another large part of this I forgot to mention earlier, if on page 60 you see $35 million of bonding. These are user finance bonds for the Rural Finance Authority. These are low interest loans that collaborate with our bankers out there and go to farmers for their operations and capital improvements, et cetera. We routinely fill that pot. It's been used more than we thought, so that's why it's not waiting for regular bonding here. This is in the bonding bill, too. I'll also point out for those that are clicking through their mind now, it does not take 81 votes in this bill because it's user-funded bonds. It's not general obligation bonds. And so a simple majority passes it. That's why it's in here. We probably wouldn't have it in the bill. But we're going to carry it in a couple places because we need that money before the end of the year. Finally, on page 61, you see Department of Veterans Affairs. Again, relatively small narratives in there. Most of the money is discretionary to be utilized by the department as they see fit. There's some additional IT monies on 62. You see the GI Bill, $1.5 million reflected on 62. Going down, you see MACV on the bottom, homeless veterans, MACV grants, that's an addition. They have $250,000 a year in the base. We added another $350,000 each year. That's for homeless veterans shelters. I know there's some in Mankato, Duluth, and various towns around the state. And then one other thing of note on page 63, Well, there's repair and betterment money that was asked for. We front-load a lot of that to get that going and get jobs out there quicker. Those are construction jobs, fixing boilers, putting in new carpet, that type of things in our homes and our department. And so you see the majority of that money front-loaded in the first year. Hopefully we can get that going. And then on the bottom, we have a supplement for our homes for food and pharmaceuticals. During our committee markup, it was testified that there was about $1.2 million a year needed for our homes for supplemental food and pharmaceuticals, and we rearranged the chess pieces and took care of that. So, Mr. Chair, again, I think it's a good bill. Compared to previous years when we were in similar situations, I think the committee did a good job in the past. If we look back about 5 years ago, the Department of Agriculture had a 27% cut as opposed to a minor cut in this bill. And Department of Veterans Affairs actually 5 years ago suffered a 10% cut to their base budget. And here you see there's actually increases in the forecasted base. So I think the priorities were good at the committee, and the work we did on this, I think, reflects those priorities, and I stand for any questions.
Okay, any questions from members? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Junkie, I'm going to go to, and I know that we're past the amendment, but I'm going to add that because it's now part of the bill as I was looking through that. On the amendment, page 6, lines 9 and 10, you add to a sentence an exception. What was your intention of that exception?
In this bill, you have, I believe it's the Hawes driver's license bill that was heard over in Transportation and Public Department of Public Services or Safety Committee. And what it does is mark the driver's license. A veteran can now choose to mark the driver's license as a veteran, to have it on your license, to utilize as an identification for a veteran. One of the huge and ongoing problems we face, and we've been working with the departments on this, is frankly, we can't identify veterans in this state. Federal paperwork is not transferred from the Federal Veterans Affairs to the state, and as we want to provide services to these veterans or understand where they reside in counties, how we disperse monies around the state for the population, we have a hard time identifying it. So the department, along with the author, Hawes, has worked we know that driver's license information is private. The only piece on that that will be allowed to be shared, and only with the department and not publicly, is that veteran's designation, so that we then can start compiling a list of where those veterans are. And again, that was an initiative brought to us by the department, and we wholeheartedly concur. It's one of the real challenges we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Junkie, it's my understanding that the purpose of the amendment was to allow the Commissioner of Veteran Affairs to receive this information?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Then, Representative Junkie, I would suggest rereading the sentence in its entirety, because as you read that sentence, it could be reasonably construed to mean that anybody can receive that information simply by making a request to the Commissioner of Veteran Affairs. You may want to change that around.
And we will, Representative. If that's what it reads, Mr. Cleary is here, our researcher, sitting behind listening intently, and he wrote this language yesterday, I believe, with the department's help. And so that is our intent. I'll state that publicly, and we only want them to receive it, no one else, and we'll make sure that's the case.
And if that's a, President Junkie, because we'll be laying this bill over a
right.
consensus amendment, the intent is not to take any amendments beyond today, but it sounds like that one would be.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Biskin, yes, not only.
Kind of a housekeeping, and we'll take that at the time we.
We can do it then, or in our stop in Ways and Means.
Just that we understand that's what we'll do. Okay. Any other discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Junkie, I'm just a little concerned about the cut to Veterans Affairs, and I see there are a lot of veterans here, and I'm wondering what effect that will have on Veterans Affairs, or if they either could testify here or if they testified earlier, and you could just sort of brief us as to what their thoughts thoughts were on that.
Well, again, Representative Pepin, as I pointed out earlier, there are no cuts in the department or the homes. There's actually increases to the forecasted base. The major cuts came from the GI Bill money being transferred around because we're not using it. If we don't use it, it falls to the bottom line. Maybe, you know, the governor can use it where he wants, or our leaders can use it where they want in those final negotiations. But we thought it best to keep it within the division, and in fact, some of the increases that you see probably came, did come from those dollars being rerouted. So, again, veterans' homes, forecast was $151,106,000. For the biennium, and we're at $153,681. That's a $2.5 million increase, and there's an increase of $928 above the forecasted base in the Department of Veterans Affairs. Again, not excluding those bottom line dollars we just talked about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie. Did the Department of Veterans Affairs testify? I'm just curious as to what they thought of your plan. You could just give me a...
Oh, Mr. Chair, and they've been in our committee for the last 3 months presenting budgets and testifying.
Representative Pepin.
So are they supportive of this, or are they not supportive?
Well, Mr. Chair, like any department, I suggest they probably support the governor's budget. The governor's budget did not include the cuts in the GI surplus dollars like we did, and I do believe either it was an oversight on the governor's budget part, or that he intended to use it later on in the budget process, because truly, if we paid attention the last years, in fact, last year, the bill you voted for and everyone else, we actually utilized this money in the same way when we did our supplemental budget bill, because we realized there was an excess in what we needed, and so we were able to hold everything whole, utilizing those dollars across the department and the veterans' homes. And we're doing that again this year for the most part. Again, not only to hold them whole, but increase slightly above the base. So I'm sure they support the governor's budget, but the governor's budget is fairly inflated based on those bottom line dollars not being needed.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Tamar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a comment, really. Representative Junkie and I have disagreed on this for many, many years, but I guess I had hoped that in this time of budget crisis that that the EA committee would have done what I think is the right thing and eliminated the ethanol producer payments completely. I realize you and I have a difference of opinion about whether we have any ethical or liability issues relative to the ethanol plants that have been getting producer payments, but to me, when we have provided $375 million in producer payments to ethanol plants to still keep the subsidy going, even though you reduced it from $30 million for the biennium to $24 million of biennium, to me is hard to swallow when we're cutting aid to cities and counties and hospitals and nursing homes and higher education. Representative Junkie continues to say that we have this, that we're liable for these payments, and if you read the statute, we're not. This is a decision that the Ag Committee is making, and I realize that ethanol has been helpful to rural Minnesota, but these plants have all made significant profits over the years. They may not be as profitable right now because ethanol, the cost of ethanol has gone down. Some of the plants are making good money still. Some of them aren't. But the statute does not require us to make these subsidies. And I don't know how I can go in my district and say, I'm cutting nursing homes, I'm cutting $150 million from the University of Minnesota, but I support $24 million in subsidies to ethanol producers. So I just want to put that on the record. It's always hard to vote against this bill, and not just because I think Representative Junkie has a good bill here, but also the veterans component is here, and you just have to take it for what it's worth. But it's worth. I obviously don't want to see any cuts to veterans programs, but I can't in good conscience vote for a bill that continues these ethanol payments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and obviously we've had lots of testimony on ethanol. Our staff believes, contrary to Representative Paymar, that we are statutorily obligated to make deficiency payments. That came back in 2003 when the governor at the time actually did eliminate the ethanol producer payments at a time of budget shortfall, but then after being lobbied heavily by the farm community, reinstated the payments and reduce them 35% from 20 to 13 cents, but with the then statutory agreement that we continue those payments as deficiency payments into the future until those payments are made whole. And so that was the original agreement with the plants, those original 12 or 15 plants. The new plants now are phase two plants, more modernized, and don't receive those payments. Members, it's one of those things that as a body you have to think about every day. If you make a commitment to a group of people as a government body, do you uphold that commitment or do you pull the rug out on it? Another classic example would be Job Z. The governor put Job Z in effect. We can agree or disagree whether that was a good program. And we did have those agreements and disagreements in debate on the floor. I was here for them. And the fact is, today we are talking about, many members, talking about discontinuing that program. But I've yet to hear one person say that we would not honor those Job Z facilities that were put in place up to the point that we may discontinue it. And no more than, and I agree with that, we should not be going back on our word with Job Z facilities as well as ethanol producer payments, which started an industry in this state to clean up our air and produce rural economic development in the state, which has been very successful. So whether you agree or disagree, I think fundamentally as a legislative body, we should really think about whether we uphold those commitments we make, and if we don't, then whether anyone in the future will ever believe any program that comes out of this place.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to, and then I'll stop, but I, because Representative Junkie and I are not going to agree on this, but I, you know, I've done a fair amount of research over this, over the years, and I think that there is another interpretation, and I just want to read something that, that the fiscal analyst who used to be with the Ag division said, wrote to me, Sam Rankin, from those of you who remember, and he said, as you are well aware, producers are arguing that because of the statute speaks to allowing producer payments for no longer than 10 years after a plant comes online, there's an implied commitment of payments for the full 10 years. To the extent that there may be a commitment, it appears to be a fairly weak one that has no identifiable teeth in it. Truth is, the legislature did at one time make a specific commitment to continue a stream of payments to certain ethanol producers in Laws of Minnesota 1988, Chapter 688. The legislature created a new subdivision in 41A, and the subdivision said, continued payments, a plant in production or under construction by January 1, 1990, shall continue to receive uninterrupted payments until Subdivision 3 of at least 20 cents a gallon of ethanol is produced until July 1, 2000. The legislature fully met its obligation to continue those payments through and beyond the commitment date. The 1988 legislature did make a promise, and subsequent legislature fulfilled it.
Mr. Chair, again, that's addressing the original plants. There's plants that have come on since then. And we have a new fiscal analyst. Now, he was worried when he said the former fiscal analyst because he thought he thought Joe Marks would just let him go. So you made him a little nervous up there. He wasn't sure what you were referring to.
I think Ms. Reinholtz is safe. Representative Grayling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a lot to add because Rep. Paymar has done his homework and is so eloquent on the issue. I spent my early years here supporting ethanol payments and subsidies as a enterprise, getting our rural economies going, and don't regret that I did that at the beginning, but I've long since also thought that they were launched and stopped supporting them, and I just want to join with Rep. Paymar and probably others here that in a $7.5 billion budget deficit, I think there's many more important programs than subsidizing this industry. When I had my last legislative survey in January that I do with my senator, we had we usually have a variety of questions, but this time we only asked about the deficit and what taxes would be people be willing to raise, if any, and what would they most like to cut. And the number one popular suggestion in my district is to stop subsidizing ethanol.
Okay, we have a couple of more people that have indicated they want to comment, and then I'd like to lay the bill over. And then we'll be dealing with that amendment when we do the realignment. But I would like to
because another bill that we'll be presenting and laying over will be Representative Murphy's, and her committee just adjourned, so she'll be up here shortly to do the presentation on her bill. So, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie, these are a few questions on the Sandy, Ojai Veterans Facility. And I want to thank you for taking out the part that you put in there that shouldn't have been in there, and you realized it shouldn't have been in there related to human services. So thank you for that. But when this amendment goes on, it's not clear to me who's going to own this hospital.
Mr. Chair and
Representative
Huntley, there's different models out there. We're still exploring that. And for the most part, the state does own it, and it's just figuring out how the paperwork. In this case, it's funded by the local government. That was similar to what happened in Fergus Falls when that facility was built. The local folks up there did the bonding, and then the state entered into a lease buyback and kind of a contract for deed, I assume is what the documents looked like, so they had full ownership of it and made those payments through their lease payments. But to qualify for veterans vouchers, it has to be a state-owned, state-controlled facility.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie, again, after the amendment, it seems like it's softened up the language on TBI a little, and I'm concerned about that because I think this is going to be a huge issue for this country.
Representative Huntley, you're exactly right, and what we did in this language, just to make it clear, we're already on the federal priority list for a geriatric MI and a nursing facility, so we didn't want to disrupt that and have to refile federal paperwork. But we added another section then that asked the commissioner to explore those public-private partnerships for TBI and PTSD and dual diagnostic work out there. If you're going to do all the work to build a mental health facility, you certainly, and the department agrees with this, you certainly should look at other areas of treatment that are needed and probably expected. And you're right, TBI, for members that don't know, TBI is the signature injury of Iraq and Afghan returning veterans, and which my son is over there till June. I always like to put a plug in there. He'll be back in June, God willing. But those veterans that are returning, we do a good job of saving lives, but they come back with a lot of concussionary injuries to their head. Sometimes it shows up the day you're back. Sometimes it shows up 5 or 10 or 20 years later. And you just never know with TBI. And so it's a problem that we know is going to be existing, and we are trying to prepare for that in Minnesota in the best way we can. So we've asked the department, in conjunction with this facility, to look at, we have a number of partners that are interested in working with us, not only to fund a unit, but to help construct and to operate a unit out there. So we are continuing to work on that. We just put it in a separate paragraph with instructions with commissioners. So it's not out, but it's just defined a little different in the language.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to recognize Representative Wagenius and then Szymanski, and then we'll lay the bill over. So, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Junkie, I'm looking on page 25 at the grants program for invasive plant species, and I'm glad to see it there. And I'm particularly glad to see a line on page 26 at the top of the page to respond to introductions of infestations of invasive species that could potentially threaten the productivity of biodiversity of wildlife and fishery habitat. So I'm glad to see this language there. I also see that you have a committee that will be evaluating invasives. And you know the question I'm getting ready to ask is about reef canary grass. Do you see that? I mean, this is certainly...
Representative Gaines, we're at least I'm having trouble hearing you on this end. So.
Okay. Sorry. Do you see this as one of the potential things that will be evaluated by this committee?
Well, Representative Gaines, the section you're looking at is a rewrite of the noxious weed bill and an upgrade of it. And you're exactly right. What this instructs the commissioner to do is every 3 years to convene this large group of experts, from nursery people to landscape people to environmental folks to ag people, and review the list of noxious weeds and invasive plants that we are trying to keep out or eliminate from this state. Their first meeting will come a year after the signature of this. They have to have that first report completed then. We don't dictate what they do, but certainly they look at all invasives. I'm sure it's a public and open meeting. I'm not sure of how they go about creating that list, Representative Wagenius, but that is their job. You're right.
The reason I bring up reed canary grass in particular, because we've had this conversation before, if there is a native weed reed canary grass, and because we had this cultivar, it contaminated the native, and they're both now invasive. And so then I look back at your language on page 8 to see that you're giving money to the Minnesota Turf Seed Council to do research on native plants. And I am worried again about the contamination issue. We took great care a couple of years ago to make sure that our wild rice stock was not going to be contaminated. Is there a possibility of taking the same great care here with additional language at some juncture to make sure that the same thing that happened to our native reed canary grass will not happen to some of our other plants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, if you have some suggestions to tighten that up a little bit, I'm happy to work with you or your staff on that. I have been up to the Turf Seed Council research site. It's fascinating up there. Our committee was up there last year, and they have a whole series of plots working with the University of Minnesota, by the way. It's their researchers and grad students up there, and discovering that next generation of, we hope, fuel crops for the state in the Zone 3, the upper zone in the state. We need two more research plots in southern and central Minnesota, which we're working on, but it's important work, and if you want to tighten it up on things so that the reed canary or the wild rice thing doesn't crop up, we can certainly look at that.
Thank you.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to Representative Junkie for all the hard work that went into the omnibus ag bill. And I just wanted to emphasize that we had some serious debate in our final markup of the bill. Relating to supplemental funding for the veterans programs and so forth, and we felt that it was important. We brought several amendments that tried to draw down some of the funding for our AURI in respect to the fact that AURI has commodity group partners that were eligible to help fund AURI, and we were looking at the governor's recommendation of reducing funding there, and wanted to use some of that funding to increase the benefits for our veterans and so forth. And we still feel strongly in the final tally, the Republicans on the Ag Committee voted against the omnibus bill. And I thought, we could still, work with you and try and make some amendments that, again, would add some additional funding where it's needed in the Veterans Affairs Department.
Again, Mr. Chair, just to reiterate, within a division you have choices to make, there's no question, and we had a lot of amendments show up in committee that was moving agriculture dollars down to Veterans Affairs, and so we have lobbyists in the room from both of those groups, and we think we had a good balanced bill. Again, ag did take a cut, $600,000 below base, but Veterans Homes had a $2.5 million increase. And Department of Veterans Affairs about $1 million increase above base, projected base. And like I say, compared with the last time the state was in this situation 5 years ago, Department of Ag took a 28% cut and Department of Veterans Affairs took a 10% cut. So we think the leadership in this body and the committee, including Representative Szymanski and others, put together a good bill on that basis, and looking historically what's happened in times of budget shortfall, we maintained and actually increased money for veterans, and that did become a priority.
Okay, we're about to lay the bill over. It. Representative Murphy, had your hand up with that relative to your coming up next or on this bill?
It has to do with this bill.
Okay, Representative Murphy.
And my bill next week.
No, we'll have your bill shortly unless... Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. I'd like to ask you a question, Representative Junkie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, would you please explain to me if you had discussions on the governor's recommendations for the Clean Water Fund that was created by the constitutional amendment in November, and how I will receive notice of those discussions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. Good question.
Yeah,
good question. I got you all in one room. I've been trying to get the discussion going. Honestly, my committee administrator, A.J. Dewar, I'll single him out. He's been working feverishly to find your committee administrator, who's been busy with Representative Riccobina's bill and not taking our calls. There's two ways we can do it. Representative Vaginius's bill that was moved out of her committee has a place marker with agriculture money in it, which we're very interested in. I don't think she wrote that section. I think she carried over most of the money that was the governor's rec. We either call that bill in and amend it with our stuff and move it out, or we can send you a separate bill, and we're asking your advice on that. So it is not included in this bill. The clean water money for the members' edification, there's clean water money from the governor suggested in agriculture, PCA, DNR, and Department of Health. And in agriculture, there's about $9 million requested. And so we will make a recommendation in whatever manner you want as a committee. In fact, we're set up for a committee hearing Tuesday of next week to do that.
Dr. Kentucky, per your request, I did have a conversation with Representative Murphy, and it was my understanding you were going to have, or our understanding when we were talking, a bill that would be sent over to her committee, a separate bill. Is that?
If that's what she wants. We're waiting for direction. Our committee has not heard. All we saw was Representative Genius's bill move out with it in it, and I asked them to call that in if it was moving, unless they wanted a separate bill. And so we haven't done anything until, again, we were trying to talk to Ms. Fine and haven't been able to communicate with her yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dunkey, I just don't have a bill.
Okay. Yeah. We'll send you a bill early next week.
Thank you.
Okay.
How about that?
That sounds very good. With that, we'll lay this bill over, and Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We only have 5 minutes left. I didn't realize at first you were saying when you said next week you were talking about the other bill. Was your bill, can you accomplish that in about 5 minutes, or should we take it up tonight? It's your choice.
Like that.
I got a bill
like $4,000.
Yeah, folks could keep the conversations they get outside. But Representative Murphy, you want to try it now? Or this evening, it's your choice.
There's no amendment.
Okay.
You don't have any amendments.
No, we don't. Representative Murphy. This is another bill that will then be laid over, and Representative Murphy moves the Cultural Outdoor Heritage Finance Division report for House File 2229, the first committee engrossment. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried.
Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 2229 be recommended to pass at some point, but laid over today.
Okay, we're just moving the first committee engrossment, and then, as I mentioned, we'll be laying it over for alignments along when we deal tonight with some alignments, and also on Friday. Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this is the Omnibus Culture and Outdoor Finance Bill. We met our target of $142,536.
Maybe if the pages close that door or something, we're getting just a lot of feedback from the hallway. Yeah, there we go. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the noise level was getting kind of high. Representative Murphy.
We met our target of $142,536,000, and I think we sufficiently fund the agencies that were within our responsibility, and that we are preserve and maintain Minnesota values and work ethics within it. But we contribute $12.1 million to the budget solution in the upcoming biennium, and the agencies that were cut, it averaged to about a 7.8% cut.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, my question was about the, I think you call them the Film and TV Board grants. They are cut, but I think less than what the governor had recommended. I wonder if you could just talk about what those dollars go for and whether you had testimony about the economic impact of that versus the dollars spent.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, the Film Board is part of the tourism account, and tourism I have to find it. They explore Minnesota tourism. Their fund base will be at $10,126,000 in fiscal year 10 and fiscal year 11 for $20,252,000. They had about a $1.5 million reduction. And the Film Board office had a small reduction. But there, and then we also funded Snowbase.
Representative Murphy, excuse me. Snowbase actually was the question I was.
$1.3 million.
Yeah. And that came in. Is that the? I guess that is. I saw it one sheet that said that it was a smaller cut. Yeah. Okay. The governor did cut it a little bit more. I just wondered if there was a reason, what the thought was behind not cutting that snow bait. According to the recommendation.
We had so much information about how valuable the film industry is to Minnesota that we were so impressed with the enthusiasm of the large numbers of people that came to testify. And even at just after 10 on a long evening of presentation by public, there were 11 or 12 people here to talk about the filmmaking industry in Minnesota and what it does to creativity and jobs in Minnesota, that we wanted to do our very best for them, and that's what we got.
Mr. Chair, yes, I think that's an answer.
Representative Paulson.
And, Mr. Chair, I would just add, yes, they did cite the economic impact numbers. They gave us the tax impact from the dollar spent. I think that's specifically the question. And they did give us specific numbers on that. Dollar spent and tax spent, which were
Mr. Chair, I guess I just, this to me is another one of those areas of sort of economic development that we sometimes do through tax credits and sometimes we do through direct subsidies, and it's always hard to show that the dollar spent there is better than leaving it out unspent or leaving it spent in a different part of the economy. And I'm not going to say anything about it other than at some point it would be much more beneficial if we had all of our economic development programs not rolled into agency-specific bills, but into an economic development budget that was act, so we could start to really compare, not by subject matter, but by effectiveness.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I had a meeting with Commissioner McElroy on Wednesday or Tuesday, late in the afternoon. I especially asked him to come in to talk about the snow bait and whether we should do credits or what was the best method. And I got the impression from talking with him that by including our money in grants, that was the most acceptable way this year.
Representative Ameren, I think you'll be the concluding one with questions then, and because we are just a couple of minutes over, and two of our divisions had to begin meeting at 10:30. So,
well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, I'm just looking at your spreadsheet, and under, I don't know what page it is. It's second page, back of the second page. There is a section under Arts Board that indicates grants program, and it looks like there's a substantial difference between what the governor proposed as spending priorities in that area versus what you're proposing. What are those grants and why the difference?
Mr. Chair, the governor recommended that the Arts Board become a 501(c)(3) program, a nonprofit. The committee did not accept that recommendation and felt that this Arts Board should be funded as it always had been, as much as possible. And the governor's cut was substantial for the Arts Board, and that meant for the grants for the regional arts councils as well, because he didn't make specific or recommendations to us, but he recommended substantial cuts of, I think it was an easing out of 50% of the funding to the Arts Board, and that also meant for the grants. And the state Arts Board has a system of awarding grants on a regular yearly basis, and the regional arts councils do also different grants, but
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, thank you very much. Specifically, what kinds of grants? I mean, because it would be significant to me to know what it is that you are preserving by doing it your way as opposed to what we would be losing by doing it the governor's way. What specific types of things does this money go to?
It goes to projects or institutions, art institutions for special projects. It goes for individual artists on a competitive basis of grants. It goes to students that are involved in particular artistic endeavors or theatrical endeavors. It's a wide range of different things. Now, that being said, we are talking with the Arts Board about how we become aware of the exact thing that you're asking, more aware of the exact thing. And I'm pretty confident that that is going to be improved in 2-3 years.
Thank you.
Okay, as I mentioned then, Representative Murphy will be laying the bill over, and just a reminder to members, we will be in recess until 6:30 this evening, and we'll be reconvening in this room. So we're in recess. I'd like to reconvene the Finance Committee, and we have Representative Leader's bill up next on transportation, the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill. Representative Campion, would you care to make a few motions for us to get the bill started?
I would, Mr. Chair. I move the Transportation Policy and Finance Division Report for House File 1309, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Campion.
Hi, I move House File 1309, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us, and I understand that the author of the bill has an author's amendment that's technical corrections, and Representative Champion is a member of that division. Would you move the amendment?
I also move the H-1309A9 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Leader, you and I talked, that's the technical amendment. Did you want to make some comments for the benefit of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, the technical amendment deals with just a minor addition. Every reference to the year 2012 should also have and 2013. So we made that correction on every line where 2012 existed. We put and 2013. That's the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, does this amendment affect any tail targets that might have been set?
Representative Leader, does the amendment affect the targets that were set?
Mr. Chair, no. The targets, we've met our targets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion carried. Representative Leader, if you'd like to go over the bill then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, the Transportation Finance Committee deals with the Transportation Department, which is highways, transit, rail, ports, airports, and we also have the accounts for parts of public safety and the Highway Patrol, and also for capital security and some minor accounts in public safety. So this bill would address all those. And in order to meet our target, we had initially to make some what do you call them, cuts to meet our target. And what we did, we cut Greater Minnesota $760,000 per year, Metro Transit $3.2 million per year, public safety support $133,000 per year, and capital security $126,000 per year. And although we made cuts here, we made adjustments back to the bill, there's basically not any new funding, but we made a lot of shifts to accommodate the problems we had in the bill. If this bill were not to pass, right now the way it exists, Metro Transit and Rural Transit would get zero increase in funding, but by the shifts that we made in the bill, we'll allow them to get to at least operate this year. Rural Transit testified last week that they have 22 operations that the department is not able to pay their money to accommodate their cash flow, so we had to make a shift from the 2009 into 2011 fiscal year to provide them to keep operating. We also have another issue that came before the Transportation Committee. Because there's high-speed rail and commuter rail federal funding available, even in the stimulus monies, the Department of Transportation doesn't have a authority to spend trunk highway monies on that. And what we've done in checking from the providers that provide transit, we've taken $250,000 from Greater Minnesota Transit and $250,000 from Metro Council, because that's general fund money. That will allow the department to access and develop plans and whatever they need to do for the rail, both commuter rail and high-speed rail. We also had a situation where the revenue for the Department of Transportation is estimated to be down $150 million this coming year, so we had to make adjustments and authorize the department to spend this or to accommodate the reduction in their revenue. And we've done that. We didn't take the whole $150 million out of the construction account like I believe the Senate did. We took $100 million out of the construction account for MnDOT, and we took $21.7 million out of the state road account, our operations and maintenance, and $17.1 million out of infrastructure investment support, and $3.7 million out of department support, and $1.5 million out of their building, and also $6 million up from the state patrol. In addition to that, those were one-time cuts. But in addition to that, there's an ongoing cut of $2.5 million from the department support. We've actually increased the state aid construction based on federal fund receipts, or estimated receipts. We anticipate that it will be increased next in fiscal 2010 for $43.5 million, and in 2011 at $130.9 million. The decrease in the 2009 appropriation for the state road construction account amounted to $44 million based on a reduction of the federal aid agreements and some advanced construction monies that were taken out of that. That adjusted the account for MnDOT. We also, in order to provide for funding for transit, we had to accommodate how we're going to pick up the $62 million for Metro Transit and the $10 million for Rural Transit. And that's general fund monies, which we don't have in this Transportation Finance Division. We don't have hardly any general fund monies, and you can't use trunk highway money. And if we wouldn't accommodate that, basically there would have been zero additional monies coming for either, as I indicated, for Metro Transit or Rural Transit. So we through with the tax committee, we made an adjustment with the what they call the tax credit. The tax credit was supposedly to roll in 2010, and that has been not effective yet, but the tax committee repealed that, and the money will be transferred to the Transportation Finance Division, and that language is in this bill, Mr. Chair. It accommodates that the transfer, and also that then provided a portion of the money that we needed for transit, both transit. We also, dealing with the Metro Council, they made some accommodations, and one of the things they agreed to is the fact that we could take $4 million from what they call their Livable Communities Fund. And the Livable Communities Fund is composed of four different accounts, and two of them, one of them is strictly the Livable Communities, and the other one is what they call the Right-of-Way Acquisition Loan Fund. And that fund has had a balance, an accrued balance, because some of the monies are being returned to that, and they had a balance of about $7 million. They allowed us to take $3 million of that and $1 million from Livable Communities, and that goes in to balance the other adjustment we made with the motor vehicle lease sales tax. Now, that's not what we used to refer to as MVAP. This is a motor vehicle lease sales tax, and the present statute says 50% for rural transit and 50% for highways. We changed that to 65 for transit and 25 for rural transit and 10% for highways. And what that does, that gave transit some money which they wouldn't have gotten. Actually, Metro Transit will get $37 million in that, and rural transit will get $14 million. If we wouldn't have made this transfer, that wouldn't have happened. There would be zero money. So that was the big reason we had to do that to balance that. So it's all contingent on these particular transfers that we made and shifts. In addition to that, in the bill, we have some riders. One of them is a bill that Representative Ruckelina has dealing with the allowing a person to pass a vehicle to exceed the speed limit up to 10 miles per hour, just for him passing the vehicle. And we also have another rider, which Representative Hornstein had a bill, but the bill was a fairly complicated bill dealing with pretty much greenhouse gas and with the vehicle miles traveled. There's kind of a language in it. He has separated the whole bill and is not moving that bill, but he took one paragraph out of it, which is now has an amended to our bill, and that's basically sets up a study with the Center for Transportation Studies, whereby they will have a study based on the greenhouse emissions and if you want to say vehicle miles traveled, but really what it amounts to there was a concern, I think, by many members that that would limit to what you could drive, and what it implies is that they could, to all effects, use transit or bicycles or walk, and it's a kind of a misnomer in a way. But anyhow, that amendment now will provide that there be a study and then reported back. There's also one more amendment, Mr. Chair, is that Representative Newton's, Representative Newton's, where it allows for disabled veterans to get free rides on transit, both metro and rural. And pretty much, there's one other issue in there. In the state aid division in MnDOT, we have the municipal state aid, and we have the, what they call a regular state aid division. Ever since the bill was passed, they were allowed an administration fee to came off the top of the funds up to 1%. We allow now that to, or was up to, I guess right, was up 1.5%. We allow it to go up to 2% now because they've got a lot more cities involved. There's a lot more work. And actually, every year, if they don't use it, the money that they don't use rolls back into the regular account anyhow, so it's not any particular problem. But that's been going on for now roughly 50 years that there's been no adjustment in that particular account. I think I mentioned about the passenger rail. I think that explains the whole bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any discussion from members? Representative Champion.
Just two quick questions, Chair Leader. A constituent asked me this question, and I thought I would put it forth to you. On page 24, on line 24.4, it has the word committed, but the notion is that there are not committed or grants or loan awards made by the council. Could you kind of explain what loans or grants are not committed or uncommitted that this would apply to? And the second question, once you answer that, is just the dollars that are coming from livable communities, whether you are concerned about any precedent that was set. And those are the two questions that my constituents asked me to put forward.
Representative Leader.
Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, you say 24.4?
Yes, sir. But it actually starts on 24.3. It says that are not committed to grant or loan awards made by the council. And the question is, what would that, what sort of things would be uncommitted, I guess, is more than a notion.
Are you looking at the engrossed, Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, are you looking at the gross?
Yeah, the first committee engrossment. Page 24. And you see right there where it says
24.4? 24.4, okay.
And you might start back at 24.3 just to kind of give you a sense of what it is. I just wanted to kind of know what that means and what funds would be deemed uncommitted.
Mr. Chair, could I just have Mr. Burris explain that? I understand it, but he could probably do it quickly.
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Matt Burris with Health Research. This provision starts a little bit higher up and deals with the transfer of funds out of the Livable Community Fund. What the language does there, in effect, is allow for a transfer of funds, but establishes that the funds can't be transferred if those monies are already obligated by the Metropolitan Council for specific projects. So it allows for transfer of essentially unobligated funds or repayments that come in that the Met Council hasn't committed to using on additional programming.
Representative Champion.
And the last question that they asked or wanted to know is whether you are concerned about any precedent that would be set by using or taking funds from the Livable Community section.
Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, you know, the Metro Council did check on that, and it's specific. It says, I believe, for 1 year, doesn't it, Mr. Burris? It says we have language in there. It's up to 2011. That's the limit. They can only take it out of that.
Representative Champion, is that?
Yeah.
You represent this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Leader, I'm curious about, and it's the same page Representative Champion pointed out, except I've got a different section I'm curious about, and it's Section 15, the maintenance of effort language. As I read this, and correct me if I'm reading it wrong, but Metro Transit, according to this language, can't increase fees or reduce service once this bill is put into law. Now, I understand that currently Metro Transit has a structural deficit. And if they're running a structural deficit, meaning they're on, in the hole right now and moving further in the hole, if we force them to maintain services on underutilized routes, then I don't know how they can meet this maintenance of effort without actually laying off employees. Can you help me understand the discussion in committee about how they'd meet this maintenance of effort language without costing jobs?
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskin, as I remember the discussions that we had, Metro Transit was, with this additional money, won't have that problem. And in 2 years, the motor vehicles excise sales tax rolls in, so they'll be benefiting by that. And I believe that they felt would accommodate this language.
Just one final question on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Leader, then on Part B, just so I understand this, because I don't sit on the committee, but Part B of the same section applies this language to transit operators receiving financial assistance. Representative Leader, does this include the opt-outs then?
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, yes, the bill addresses the opt-outs also.
Okay. So, well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Leader, the bill might, but does this section in particular, in other words, one of the reasons for opting out was to try to develop services that were more specific to the region in which the transit providers served. However, if we're going to start putting them under these blanket regulations, then we start eroding the whole concept of opt-out. Does this section here, the maintenance of effort section, affect the opt-outs? Or I understand there are parts in the entire bill that affect the opt-outs. I'm just wondering if the maintenance of effort language affects the opt-outs.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask someone, but I believe that was correct. It's my understanding because they participate in the funding from Metro Council, and they were part of the group. But as I remember going through the whole workshop, they are part of it, and I might be need to be corrected, but that was my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have other questions? Well, seeing none, then Representative Leader, Representative Champion, excuse me. Renews his motion that House File 1309, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. See no further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We now will be taking up the early childhood Finance and Policy Division, House File 2088, and Representative Follick, would you like to move your division report?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division report for House File 2088, the first committee engrossment.
The motion is before it. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Follick, would you move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2088 for committee engrossment be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
See, the motion is before us, and I understand you have an author's amendment that's a technical amendment.
Yes, I have the A3, and it is a technical amendment.
Okay, would you move it in?
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I do appreciate the opportunity. Prior to us dealing with the author's amendment, I just have a question on the motion that's before us, that the bill be recommended to pass and be re-referred. I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, you taking the time to have walked me through the process of laying bills over, matching up to come together with Senate files, and explaining that process as a member new to this committee. Mr. Chair, is it your understanding that the Senate is, well, they can't. The early childhood component is in the K-12 component, which has already passed out of the Senate. So I don't understand, if we set up a process, why this motion is before us rather than laying the bill over until the K-12 bill comes and merging the two bills together, which was the appropriate process that I thought we had agreed.
Representative Biskins, I'm trying to recall our conversation. I don't recall if we talked about this one or not, there was some interest in having the early childhood bill pass as a separate bill, and I understand it would not match up with the Senate, but what we quite frankly wanted to do, and the chair of this committee and the chair of that division have a long history of trying to elevate the just to elevate the understanding, if you will, of some of the early childhood issues. In fact, when I chaired the Education Committee, I requested of the Speaker at the time to appoint an early childhood division of the Education Committee. And so what we're attempting to do is increase the visibility of the early childhood bill and initiatives, and when we are done and the bill passes the Minnesota House, and under the rules and traditions of FITS, it will become a part of the K-12 conference committee, or part of the DHS, or both. Yeah, it will be split at that point, and the two conference committees will take up their relevant parts of the bill. But that's the simple answer from my perspective, but I would call on the division chair to add anything to what I had to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, Representative Biskins, we had a change in structure this year. You might remember last year that the three education chairs reported to Mary Murphy's committee. So Representative Greiling, Representative Rukavina, and myself reported up through Mary Murphy, and then we went to finance through that process, and we split here in the finance committee. This year, we all report directly to finance, so each one of us has a direct connection to the finance committee. So for that reason, as K-12 will go on to the House floor and higher ed, then early ed also will. And as the chair said, it will split afterwards, half to Tom Huntley's bill and half to the Department bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I can understand it. I will say, unfortunately, though, for a citizen of the state of Minnesota, I think it's fair warning, if you're going to follow the progress of an issue area, keep your eye on the Senate, because eventually they're going to match up with the Senate bill, not with the House, and I think that's unfortunate.
Although Representative Biskins has to debate it, I think if the public is, that's my whole point, if the public is following early childhood issues, they will see this bill moving forward through the House as a separate bill, and we'll be able to follow the discussion that takes place. And like I said, I've got a long history going back. When were you first elected?
In 96, so it was the 97 session.
So that's when I made that request of Speaker Carruthers at the time to create a separate division. And I always had wished that the Senate would have done the same, because I've always been interested in elevating the early childhood issues. And when I chaired the Education Committee, I think I sat in on virtually every single early childhood meeting that we held. It's a very important area in my view, and I think the committee chair of the chair of the division probably concurs with what I'm saying. But at any rate, you make a good point, and if I didn't visit with you on that one, I will apologize. I
when we talked about how we were going to align things. In fact, the decision on how to align this one wasn't really made until, in a final sense, until just the last 2 days.
Mr. Chair, and no need to apologize. We touched on this issue briefly when we
did. Okay, I hope that we had. Yeah. Okay, if you'd... that's right. We started to deal with the amendment. Representative Follett had moved the author's amendment. And any discussion then on the author's amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. And then Representative Follett on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the Omnibus Early Childhood Finance and Policy Bill. And I want to thank our committee for putting together a very good bill and the staff. I do have my fiscal analyst here, Emily Adrians, if there's any questions around the fiscal issues. I think from the Finance Committee here, we have Representative Greiling. Sir Greiling sits on our committee, as well as Representative Biffkin sits on the Early Childhood Committee. So appreciate their work as well. Our budget really encompasses two departments, as was mentioned. The Minnesota Department of Education, which we have our first three articles. Article 1, which is the early childhood portion, early childhood education. Article 2, which is community education and prevention. Article 3, which is self-sufficiency and lifelong learning. And then we have the Department of Human Services portion of the bill, which is the child care assistance programs, MFIT child care, basic sliding fee, and child care development grants. When we started out this year, members, we had three goals in our committee. One was to close the achievement gap, which is something I think a lot of the education committees have been working on. It's something, if we can close it early, makes a big difference and helps out with Representative Greiling's committee, is to get the kids ready. Getting more kids ready for kindergarten, so making sure in that four-year-old year, in particular, we're supporting kids, and we're also identifying kids early in terms of any learning needs. And last, our goal was to increase quality in all of early education. This bill, members, that our committee put together does all of those things. First of all, we have two reform initiatives. One is called the Office of Early Learning. It takes both the DHS programs and the MDE programs, puts them together with no extra staff, but allows them to coordinate and align early education programs under one set of standards. And that's really our goal in early ed, have one set of standards of which the programs can flow out of. So that's, this does that. We did receive a zero target, and our budget is about $455 million. Our second big initiative is for the quality rating system. When you think of rating systems, members, you think of things like restaurants, 1 to 5 stars, hotels, 1 to 5 stars. I think all of us want to go to the 5 stars, and probably not many of us want to go to the 1 stars when we think about that. In this case, if you think of a child care, when you're a consumer, a parent, a grandparent, you're out there looking for quality child care, this is the way so you can tell the difference in child care and what's good, high quality. In our case, it would be a 4 star, and what would be the lower quality, which would be 1 star. So starting to have a system where we can rank the quality and how kids are doing, and also for consumers, for parents to shop child care. Steps that we've taken towards a statewide quality rating system, we fund a program called Parent Aware, which is right now being piloted by the Mel Foundation. We have grants for, in this bill, grants for getting ready for ratings. So providers out there are wondering how they get ready for this, how they're going to be rated, how they can get grants to help them. We have language requiring Department of Human Services to increasingly award grants for quality purposes. And we add those that are rated at 3 and 4 stars in Parent Aware to those eligible for the provider rate differential. So they get extra money, 50% above the maximum rate, for reaching that 3 or 4 star level. So those are two very innovative things we're doing. In this bill, we did take almost all of the governor's policy recommendations for the Minnesota Department of Education. Yesterday, in our committee, the 12-hour requirement, minimum requirement for school readiness was amended out. I think some of you may have got some letters about that. Some people were a little bit up in arms about that. So that is gone. We took the retroactive eligibility and the governor's recommendations for DHS, which is a savings of about $304,000. We did not take the governor's recommendations of a 3% cut to the market rate for child care. We did not take the governor's recommendation to increase parent co-pays. We are lucky in our committee in that we have stimulus funds, about 26 $1 million in stimulus funds is included in this bill. We decided to incorporate it. I know some of the committees did it separately, and some are incorporating. We're doing it that way. We're strategically using the one-time stimulus dollars. It comes through the Child Care Development Block Grant. You've all heard about how these funds come through formulas, and that's where ours is coming through. Minnesota submits a plan every 2 years, and we receive funding for these CCAP funding for quality purposes. Of the $26 million, $3.4 million is set aside for quality. So we have worked hard with the department to make sure we have agreement on the $3.4 million and how we're going to spend that. We're proposing to spend $750,000 on family, friend, and neighbor grants. I think, as a lot of you know, members, that there's center-based care, there's family child care, the family, friend, and neighbor that's happening out in your neighborhoods is also a kind of care that's very popular. We want to make sure we're looking at the quality of that care. We're going to put $1.26 million into getting ready for ratings. So providers out there, again, are saying, hey, how do we become part of the system? How do we improve to be a 2 or 3 or 4, ideally a 4-star system? So we have $1.26 million going in for that, for grants. And Parents Aware, which is the pilot program, we put in $1.4 million, and that's where we're transitioning. MELF is transitioning it back to the state because they run out of funding in 2011. For the bulk of the subsidy, which is $22.6 million, we are spending $14.3 million on basic sliding fee waiting lists. So those waiting lists you've heard about, there's about 7,000 kids and families on waiting lists waiting for child care to support their work so they can go out and earn a paycheck knowing their kids are in high-quality care. This will put $14 million towards that. Provider reimbursement rate of 2%. $6.9 million. Again, making sure federally when they set up child care, they wanted to make sure all kids, no matter where they lived, were able to get the same kind of care so that if you had a government subsidy, you weren't necessarily getting lower care than your neighbor who might be paying for a certain kind of care. So they do a market rate survey and they make sure that subsidized care is at a level that kids can get the same quality in their care. So we'll put about $6.9 million into that. And School Readiness Connections, we're going to put $1.3 million into that. That's where we have currently 14 providers that align with both the quality rating system and the governor and the basic sliding fee understanding to continue this program. But so that's been good. It's a program where we're continuing to increase quality with the child care providers. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, that is the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Bill.
Okay, any discussion on the bill? Well, seeing then, none then, Representative Follick removes her, or renews her motion that House File 2088, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we will now go to House File 2123 by Representative Wagenius, the Environmental and Natural Resource Omnibus Finance Bill. And members, per our earlier discussion about bills being folded in and so on a little bit later, this is one that we'll be making some of those motions with that will be a little different than what we just did with Early Childhood. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I move the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division report for House File 2123 of the First Committee Engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Wagenius?
I move the House File 2123, the First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us, and I understand, Representative Wagenius, you have an author's amendment.
Yes, and I don't have a copy with me right here, so I would ask the page if they bring me a copy. Thank you.
I've got one here. Yeah, they're okay.
We're welcoming our fiscal analyst, Jim Reinhold.
Welcome back. He was here this morning.
Members, there are just three parts of this amendment. Some of it's just technical cleanup that happens every time you get a bill this size. Secondly, at the back in sections 32, the Pollution Control Agency has a fee increase, and we've been carrying it on our spreadsheet, and they just noticed that the language wasn't in there, so we are including the language. And finally, I had been working with Representative Sarah Anderson on some language. She had language in the committee to have more transparency and outcomes for the grants that we fund, and so we did not have a complete copy in our last night, and so we have a copy here today, and I would like to move the amendment including those three things.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Hatchberg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wagenius, could you explain, I don't think you talked about lines 2.13 to 2.18 in your explanation of the amendment.
And I didn't hear what you said.
Line 2.13 to 2.18, explanation of that language.
Oh, I am sorry. This was one of what I consider one of the technical amendments. And we mentioned it last night in committee. We had intended to have $400,000 for coming from the snowmobile account for this is additional money for operation and maintenance. And when Representative Bill requested that, I misunderstood. I thought it was 200 a year to add up to 400, and what he had meant was 400 a year. That's all. And so we are correcting that misunderstanding.
Thank you.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, and all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Wagenius on the bill then as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, and several committee members here that are on the Environment, Finance, Representative Hughes, Representative Farr, Representative Hatchbar. Thanks for working on together on this bill. This committee, the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee, faced one of the same tensions that all the committees are facing, and that's to make the needed cuts. Our target was 6%, and to do as little job loss as we could possibly do. But we had an added tension, and that's that obviously we needed to make cuts to meet our target, but the cross purpose was no cut because of the language accompanying the constitutional amendment that said no substituting new money for traditional funding. So we had to consider that as we were putting this bill together. There are many definitions of this supplanting, and the committee had many discussions of this, and I think there were as many opinions of what that meant as there were people on the committee. But I think in the end, we found the most trouble was with Waters. And when the committee looked at the issue, not in a legalistic way, but with the expectation of citizens that the new clean water money be used for cleanup and not to fund agencies' fundamental responsibilities. And so you will see that reflected in what we did in the bill. I'm just going to go through very quickly and tell you in the general fund summary by agency, the governor recommended a 7.8% cut in PCA. We did a 10% cut, but I do want to let you know that most of the money for PCA actually comes from what's called the Environment Fund. And that fund is funded in the majority by your waste fees and commercial waste fees.
there are other fees in that fund too, but they're hazardous waste and other kinds of fees like that. But that's the main source of funding. And one of the main problems that this agency is having, because and we'll chat more about that as we go through. The natural resources funding, the governor recommended a 7.5% cut. We did a 6.6. The governor recommended the Board of Water and Soil Resources a 10% cut. We did a 5.7. Our governor recommended Metropolitan Council Parks a 10% cut. We did 6%. And the governor recommended the Conservation Corps be cut by 5.1%. We chose not to do any cut for that, particularly given the recession that we're in right now. So with that, what I would like to do is just spend a little bit of time with the spreadsheet on the change items. And you will see that much of what we have done are the governor's recommendations, but there are some differences, and it's the differences between what the governor recommended and what we did that I will highlight. But I want you to start by looking at line 25, and that is the clean water funding. It's in the fund column. It's called CWF. That funding is not in this bill. So the numbers here will be different because our committee's recommendation for that funding went to Representative Murphy's committee. So the governor funded it in all one lump here, and we split it apart. Similarly, with the park, we sent a recommendation to Representative Murphy's committee. That's just the difference. I'm going to start with line 16 and just go over some of the differences here. We funded a program called River Watch up in the Red River area. They had asked for clean water money, new money, and that's one of the places that we decided it was best to use general fund money, because we were trying to do a straightforward reading of the constitutional language, and it did not seem to include education, though this Riverwatch project had a large education component. Good project. We funded some sewage system inventory grants here. Some wanted to use the new clean water money for that. But just to give you a sense of the committee thinking, we saw that as a standard regulatory program, and as a standard regulatory program should be funded in the regular omnibus budget and not put in the new clean water budget. There are some new standards proposed for keeping water on the land in the urban areas. That's line 18. On line 22, this is the biggest change, the difference from the governor, and that is the same funding that we did 2 years ago to assess and monitor our water for cleanup and this is the same number we carried 2 years ago, with the intention that 10% of our water be monitored every year. So we are on a 10-year schedule, and that is what we are doing with this bill. This kind of monitoring is a basic responsibility of the Pollution Control Agency, and water monitoring has been traditionally funded by the Pollution Control Agency, and that's why he put it in this budget and chose not to put it in to the clean water money. If you go to page 4, I'm going to just highlight a couple of places here where there are differences. And this is in the multimedia program. The Pollution Control Agency We took the chair's advice, did some reprioritizing, and had some money available for monitoring our waters. And some of the things that multimedia are doing, we suggested, were just not as high a priority. One of the things they're doing is doing a survey of the state to see about environmental awareness. They have designated that we are a C state and wanted to get to be a C-plus state, but given the fact that we have the priority of waters for one and the others that we just had a constitutional amendment with a vote, it didn't seem necessary to do these kinds of things. On line 98, you will see composting grants that to counties and other local units of government. That is a Representative Saylor bill, and it's we'll talk about that bill later if you'd like to do that. So I go from the Pollution Control Agency to DNR and Lands and Minerals, which is the same as the governor. Water resources, there are some changes, and I'm now looking on line 209. The agency said they could finish the shoreline rules without $1 million, so we took them up on that. The governor recommended a total cut in the Red River Mediation Board. We did not do that. We funded them. So those are a couple that I just highlight for you. One of the others, if you're looking down on line 243, the governor recommended that we spend $2 million a year for folks who can mark forests for timber cutting. We fully funded that, but when there was private landowner assistance, we did take a cut to that. The governor recommended a study on forest productivity. It seems very ill-defined, and we chose not to fund that. On line 300, now we're in trails and waterways. There was one thing deleted in committee that the governor had recommended. Other than that, trails and waterways, I think, is just pretty much the same. In fish and wildlife, if you will look at, there are changes, and I'm going to just point out four of them to you on lines 339. 341, 342, and 344. We did not take the cuts that the governor recommended, and that was with the heritage bill in mind, because these were all heritage-type dollars, things going to the same things that the heritage fund would fund, and we thought that would be supplanting. So we chose not to reduce those traditional sources of funding to the extent that the governor wanted to do. Okay. In ecological services, we are at the same level. That's on page 10. Enforcement programs of a 6% cut, and I will tell members that that is concerning to the DNR. They have visited me about that. They've traditionally had 400 hours on officer overtime built into the budget, and at $2 million a year, that it seems to be more than this committee could fund. But I'm sure we're going to hear about that issue again. There is still money for overtime, but not that much. And I have asked DNR to let us know exactly how much money is there for overtime in the budget, because there is still money. Okay. There is, I'll call to your attention on page 12, a general fund reduction to DNR that's unspecified, but we did ask DNR to come back to us and let us know how they made those cuts and what outcomes will be missing because of those cuts. So now we're on Bowser, and that's on page 14 of the spreadsheet. It's pretty self-explanatory. There are some changes, but I would point out three that are more significant. The governor recommended big cuts to the Red River Basin Board, the Minnesota Rivers Joint Powers Board, and the floodplain grants at Area 2 down in southwest Minnesota. We did take cuts, but they were 10% cuts rather than wipeout cuts. So let me go. In Metropolitan Council now, we're on page 15. There was a 6% cut. And as I told you before, the Minnesota Conservation Corps, there was no cut. We're now at revenue on page 16, and let me just go through that for a minute for you. We are having the PCA fines, instead of going into the general fund, come into the water program to fund that water program, which is severely underfunded, and using the solid waste tax to fund it. So one of the other things we're doing, and there are a couple spreadsheets that I will point out to you, and it's probably much easier to look at on the spreadsheet than on this one, the smaller spreadsheet. You can see that on line, on this spreadsheet that looks like this, you can see that we are adopting fees that are in the process of rulemaking by the Pollution Control Agency. So you can see the current fees in the water program. You can see the proposed water quality fees that they are doing the rulemaking in. It brings in $6 million, and you can see how they're allocated. Even bringing that in, the water program permits are not being funded by the permittee. We are still doing a subsidy from the solid waste tax, where there is this $89 million mountain of debt that we can talk about if you would like. So that's just to give you some help with the fees that we are in, looking at. So that's one of them, and that's the adapting of the PCA rule. The second thing, and if you look on this sheet, it's easier to see rather than on the traditional spreadsheet. We are asking that people who get certificates from the Food Control Agency pay the full cost rather than having the solid waste fee and taxpayers who pay that tax pay for it. And we are asking that people who get environmental assessment worksheets pay the cost of those worksheets, except for those folks that for local units of government which will have 10 free hours. So that sums up those increases. And with that, the only other thing I would I can go over the bill language, but I think I've gone over much of the financial already with you and members. That would be your choice. I can just point out that we are also asking the Commissioner of Pollution Control Agency for the next biennium to do rulemaking to fully fund or have people who get permits pay for those permits. and that would be on page 3 of this bill. Other than that, instead of going through the riders, I would call your attention to some of the statutory language at the back. So I'd be glad to go through the riders. I think much of that I've covered, and I would be repeating myself. But I would go back to the language which starts on page 29 and go through that very rapidly for you, because one of the things we're doing in here is carrying a number of governor's recommendations for DNR for people who get permits to pay their own fees. The only one that I see that brings in anywhere near significant money is if DNR gives a permit to somebody to lay utility lines over their property or water. There are fees for that, and we have been subsidizing those fees for years, and now this bill says, well, folks, the utility companies who are asking for this permission should pay those fees. So with that, I'm just going to go through this real quickly. On line page 29 is the governor's rec. There's a new gift card on page 30 that's Representative Hansen's bill. But then the fees to DNR start on line 30. On page 30, line 27. And you will see this kind of fee language in 3111, that's the utility fee crossing. On the bottom of page 3130, it's the conveyance of interest in land to state and federal government, the fees for that, for road easements across state land. On page 32, for conveyance of unneeded state easements on page 33, and then we get to page 34, we have, again, a Representative Hackstar's bill with non-resident all-terrain vehicle state trail pass, and that language will go through several pages. And then we're back to governor's recommendations on page 36 for easements for ingress and egress, and those are, again, fees for people who make permit applications. On line 36-24, you'll see that there will be no charge for a veteran, no matter whether they live in Minnesota or not, who is totally and permanently service, has a total and permanent service connected disability. Representative Junkie's bill starts on line 37.8, and that's for horse trail passes. Online, on page 38, there are mining fees, again, a governor's rec, and you'll see those. And then there are reclamation fees on line 39, line 39-25, again, a governor's rec. It's a reclamation fee on taconite ore or produce. And that that is on line page 41 at the top. A fee owner is subject to a reclamation fee of 0.75 cents per ton of taconite ore mined from minerals or mineral rights owned by the fee owner. But the fee owner may enter into an agreement with the mining operator to make the payment. Okay, on there's some there. Year and lifetime licenses, again, the governor's rec, and again in DNR, permit applications for our environmental review covering the cost, the permit. The DNR can select the reasonable cost incurred for environmental review, again, a governor's rec. And then we're on to one of the things I mentioned in the spreadsheet, Representing Eatonsville. This is on page 43. The agency may develop performance standards, design standards, or other tools to enable and promote the implementation of low-impact development, probably for the more urban areas, or it is probably for the more urban areas. Representative Sailor's bills in Section 33 about just changing a bit of the e-waste language, but her on Section 35, now I'm on page 46, is establishing a grant program to political subdivisions to increase composting, reduce the amount of organic waste entering disposal facilities, and reduce the cost associated with hauling waste by locating the composting site as close as possible to the site where the waste is generated. This will be a long-term saving to the state and to people who generate waste. Representative Gardner's bill is on page 47, and that's one that says if you're going to use plastic bags for composting yard waste, they need to be biodegradable. Now we've got some on page 47, lines 26. That is where we say that permits the permittee may be charged the amount to cover the reasonable cost of developing, reviewing, and acting upon applications for agency permits that would be in PCA. Let me just go on. There's just a couple more things I want to point out to you. It's on page 49-29, where we change from may to shall to say that certificates shall be covered by the person who is applying for them, the cost. Representative Knuth's bill starts on page 50, line 70, and this is a bill to protect children by identifying chemicals of high concern and listing those chemicals as priority chemicals. Representative Knuth is here, so I'm going to defer any questions to her on that. And let me just see if there are any other things I want to draw to your attention. I think there's one more thing I want to draw to your attention. Yes, on page 5623, is the language that says that the proposer of a specific action for the reasonable cost of preparing and distributing an environmental assessment worksheet shall be paid for by the applicant with the 10 hours of essential free time going to local units of government. With that, there are a number of reports at the back of the bill. I just want to make sure we highlight the financial things. I think that takes care of that. One of the things that, one of the concerns that has been brought up, and we had many discussions and a long hearing on it, was the cost that the agencies charge, or the time it takes, not the cost as much as the time it takes for an agency, particularly for a control agency, to do environmental review. And so on page 65, line 24, we ask them to report back to us about streamlining the process, and we want to hear from them by next January on ways to streamline the process. And lots of suggestions have been made, but I think it was important to formalize that, and that is what this language does. And with that, members, I'd be glad to answer questions.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair and member, Representative Vaginius, or maybe Representative Knuth, on page 50, starting with the assessment of the identifying of chemicals of high concern. There's lots of requirements for the environmental protection of the PCA to do this in departments. Is there a fiscal note associated with that? And if there is, there has to be a cost, and where does that cost appear in your spreadsheet?
In the main, this is a cost to the Department of Health, so we don't carry that in here. We have not gotten a fiscal note from the Pollution Control Agency for this. I don't expect this to be a substantial cost, and I don't expect this to be more than a cost that they could cover.
Well, I think that it's important to have that a document for that, because there's a quite a bit of requirements of the Pollution Control Agency. I don't think they're bad or good. That's beside the point.
Right.
This has been around for, has been through several committees, and I think I raised that committee in another committee, and I'm surprised that there hasn't been a fiscal note requested, and I would think before it goes much farther that we have a complete fiscal note on those.
It has been requested.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, a couple of things. One, I'm sort of surprised at the large amount of overtime at a time when we're having great employment problems and so forth. Has there ever been an analysis of what just having the right number of people on board to avoid overtime would do as opposed to the cost of overtime?
Thank you for asking that question, Representative Kahn. The agency will argue that it is sometimes more efficient to have overtime costs. But at the rate that they were charging overtime at $2 million a year, I asked the very same question that you have asked. And it seems to me that it would be more efficient to have more staff and less overtime. One of the interesting things that I found out today when you bring up these issues is that in the last classes that were brought in of new people, they were brought in a very high level of salary because they were brought from other agencies like the State Patrol, classes of conservation officers. That was troubling to me because that is more costly, and not giving younger people an opportunity that I think they should have. I have asked the agency, asked the DNR, to tell us exactly how many hours of overtime will be left after we did the 6% cut. I don't have a number on that because they would say, well, we use what is left over. But that's not a particularly good answer for the question. If I can't answer it, then we've asked the question.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
President,
I would think that would be a good question to pose to the legislative auditor in terms of fiscal responsibility. I would certainly understand how in a part of the state where there were very few people, and there were very few people needed, and you had a certain event that overtime might be much more effective than staffing up for it. But I certainly think that that's something, particularly now at this time when there are clearly employment problems over the state. And another question I have is that I haven't noticed, I think I look at these bills every year, but I haven't noticed, when was the last time that we increased watercraft fees? It's only fee I think I regularly pay the DNR, and I'm really upset that it hasn't been increased when there are needs for a long time. So when is the last time that that's been done?
Rep. Samoginia.
I cannot answer that question. I can say it was not increased in this bill and it was not increased in the last biennium.
Well, I'm
Rep. Samoginia.
Chairman, that's something I really think, I think at this time, particularly the level of the size of the boats, most people who own a boat could take some increase in the fee. And I don't care if you even do it just on kayaks and canoes, but
Representative Kahn, did you know the answer to that question?
What?
Or did you know the answer to the question as to when the last time was?
I didn't know the answer, but I didn't think it had been done recently because I kind of looked for that.
I mean, the way you posed the question, I wasn't sure if you maybe knew, but...
No, I didn't.
I'm getting hand signals from the audience that it was 06.
Oh, 06, okay.
05, but...
Oh. 05, okay. We're getting all kinds of answers from Representative Kahn.
Okay.
Okay,
well, I'd like to congratulate Representative Hatchberg in having done a good job on that.
You indicated you had another question, Representative?
No, that was it. Okay. That was the two.
Next one is Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Kahn, I suggest you buy an ATV and a snowmobile. They go up all the time. And you get nothing for it other than arrested. So you don't get a trail, you just get arrested. I'm the right, who's getting paid from the fund that it got increased. I'm not tracking Representative Wagenius. The Natural Resource Fund is obviously just a fund where you take fees and you put it in and you replace what used to be paid to general fund dollars. So I just have to understand the mining fees here, because are all the new fees on page 39 and 38, are they new fees then on top of the new Mineland Reclamation fee?
I am going to defer to our fiscal analyst for that.
Mr. Reynolds.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rusty, the fees in here are new fees recommended by the governor. They are the agency cost of mine reclamation, but a part of those fees are new.
Well,
Mr. Chair,
and Representative Genius, I'm talking about not just the mine, the permit to mine fee is $60,000 and $30,000 if there's been no production on page 39 on line 39.29. What are those fees for? To go out to see if they're still mining? You can look from the highway for $5.
Mr. Reinhold.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rufina, the committee directed the DNR in previous bill to come back with a proposal where they covered the cost of their permit operations and also their reclamation operations in the mining division to be covered by the fees, and that's what these fees have been.
Well, is there, Mr. Meyer is here, and I, this is, you know, I'm not, you know, I mean, I've been around mines all my life, and my father was around mines, and my grandfather was around mines, and, you know, but it seems rather stiff here as far as the fee is concerned, to every year charge $60,000 for what purpose? It costs $60,000 to write a permit, Mr. Meyer, each year for six mining companies?
That's the question, Mr. Myers, and he needs to respond. He should come down.
I know. So, Mr. Myers, if you'd come down, I really, if this is what you came back to propose, you know, there's six operating mines now, isn't there? Six operating mines, so it's $360,000 to write a couple pieces of paper. They're doing the same thing every year.
Director
Bates, from Latin America, will address those questions.
Okay, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Marty Bates. I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division for DNR. And I think the question is why? What's the cost for? Is that the question? Mm-hmm. last legislative session, DNR was given the direction to come back to this session with the full cost of issuing and monitoring permits, the permit to mine, and that was for taconite, for non-ferrous, and for peat. And so what this represents is, and in that report that we came back with, we offered five options on how that might be paid for and didn't make a recommendation on any particular option to select. In the governor's budget, there's a combination of the options that were in that report, and one is a fee that's charged annually for the cost manage existing permit to mine, and also there's a fee to taconite fee owners. It's 0.75 for each ton of taconite mined, and there's also the ability to charge for a newer amended permit. So we would bill time as we do with environmental review now. If someone has EAW or EIS, there's a mechanism to charge the staff time working on that. This bill would enable staff time spent on the permit to be charged for. And what the cost represents is the full cost of the mine land reclamation program of the Department of Natural Resources.
But Mr. Chair, I'm not into the permit, the mine land reclamation program yet, Mr. Bates. I'm asking you, so every year you are going to write on a piece of paper that MNTAC, you can keep mining, and you're going to charge them $60,000 every year. Then you're going to write Inland Steel, you can keep mining, and you're going to charge them $60,000 every year. And Cleveland Cliffs, you can mine at Evlitac and Evtac now, it's called, and Keytac, and North Shore Mining, MNTAC, whatever. And you're going to charge them $60,000 to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, the kinds of activities that go into an existing permit is companies are responsible for turning in an annual operating plan, and DNR is required to review and approve that operating plan, make site visits to assure that the reclamation that's being proposed is being complete. DNR is also
you're mixing up. You're charging over $2 million a year to do the reclamation to see if it's done. You're just charging $60,000 here. I'm asking you what $360,000 does every year. That permit to mine is a five-year permit, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, the permit to mine lasts for the life of the operation until...
So it's a 30-year permit.
It could be as long as 50 or 100 years.
Okay, so you charge them once, they gave you a plan, and then you're going to charge them 50. I don't understand what the charge is for.
Mr. Chairman, there's an annual operating plan that that company submits, and then there's the annual inspections. It's not a permit where it's issued once and it's good for the life of operation. There's constant yearly monitoring of the operation. And DNR is also the local government authority for the Wetland Conservation Act. So we also do the wetland replacement monitoring and plans with mining operations.
Well, Representative Rukavina, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to prolong this. I mean, the governor then, if this is the governor's doing, he's just increased taxes by, you know, calling them fees of over $2.5 million a year to do what typically is being done already. And just one last question, Mr. Bates, for the mine and reclamation plan, what do they get for little over $2 million, $2.4 million a year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I think that's an error in the spreadsheet. I think that the amount that's listed totals up that new fee for easements and leases. It's $1.2 million a year is for the mine land reclamation fee.
Well, 0.075 times, maybe somebody with a calculator times 39 million. I imagine you're going to do it on the 3-year average like we do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rubino, that's not in this bill, but that's a pretty good idea.
So let's just use 40 and we'll say 0.075, not quite 1 cent, times 40 million tons is what? So how does it get to be 1.8 if it's 3?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, that's per ton of crude ore, not pellet. And
well, crude ore is 3 times more.
It's also then based on a non-state or non-federal ore, so it's privately owned ore.
So to reclaim your mine costs nothing.
Go through the chair.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I'm getting this is flabbergasting to me. You, first of all, Mr. Chair and members, the fee owners are not going to pay this, because the fee owners and I don't know what is mined on state and federal, but it's mostly state and school trust land that's being mined. I don't know what the fee owners are a year. I don't know what they are. I actually don't know what that number is. But they will just, they have agreements with the mining companies in order to mine our ore, which some of them get $40,000 a day, and they pay no taxes. Listen, if you think us razors haven't figured out, tried to figure out a way in the last 100 years to tax these people, you're out of your mind. And we can't do it. So this is just going to be passed on to the mines and their royalty. And did you charge the mining companies when you did their royalty fee? Did you charge them to reclaim the mine and the royalty fee at the DNR? Is there a royalty reclamation fee in the royalty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, there is not.
There isn't?
Not in state-owned land, no.
And is and other lands, is there?
Mr. Chairman, this bill would establish that fee for recovering the cost from mineral fee owners, but that doesn't exist now.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on
Wait now, can we figure out, hold on, Mr. Chair, Representative Sober, calm me down a few months. But anyway, I'm still at 0.075 cents. 0.0 whatever, 0.75 cents times 40 million equals what?
Well, 3 million.
3 million.
3 million a year. So where is it 1.8 when it's 3?
Plus, so
Mr. Madison.
Mr. Chairman.
Because it's only on, that's right, it's only on.
But it's crude, that's more important.
Maybe we should not have too many side conversations. I recognize you one
Mr.
at a time.
Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Rukavina saw us before.
Mr. Chair, members, I, you know, God, nobody likes to tinker and monkey with the mining companies more than me, but this is really nothing more than a huge tax to pay for people that go out and are doing a job already and have been charged. The companies have been charged already, and I don't understand what they're getting for it. And there's nothing to prod you to get things done faster if you can just charge them. But that's
okay. Representative Fulbert.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vitas, a reclamation isn't necessarily done at the same year that the mining is done. In fact, it might be 20 years later. Where the fee owner is subject to this reclamation fee, you're not going to spend that fee. What are you going to do with the money?
Mr. Vance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Colbert, I understand your question. It's that ton of ore is mined, and that particular spot may not be reclaimed for some time in the future. We're going to bank that money and wait to reclaim.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, this is intended to cover the yearly cost of reclamation activities, so that money that's generated would be used in the next year for the reclamation activities. And I guess I would like to point out, Mr. Chair, that this program has been funded by the general fund for 40 years. And it was at the direction of the legislature last year to come back with the full cost of issuing and monitoring reclamation permits and options for funding that. So that's what we did. And
Mr. Chairman, I think under state law, the mining company is required to reclaim the land. That was not the case until the 80s, and that's why we have the problem with the Kenneth Steel Mine. But as part of their mining permits, when they get done, they have to reclaim the land. So this is just to monitor their reclamation?
Mr. Chairman, this is for issuing and monitoring the permits mined. And so it's all aspects, the initial permit conditions, working through an EIS and eventual permit conditions, and then monitoring to ensure that the reclamation standards are met. It's for the Wetland Conservation Act portion of it. It is also for some research to understand what the environmental issues are and how to deal with them from mining. And so this is the full cost of that program.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you've thrown the kitchen sink and the bathroom sink in the full cost of it. I mean, it seems to me that the mining company is required to reclaim the land. And that's what we want to be as part of their cost. That's already state law and has been for a considerable amount of time. But this is on top of that, just to monitor it. And that seems like an awful lot of money. Now, if it's 3/4% on the crude ore, that's at least
120 million.
At least three times as much as the 40 million taconite that is mined. So that's $9 million on that. And I understand you're doing research with it. How does research have anything to do with reclaiming it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, it would be things like the work that we're doing on reducing mercury emissions from taconite plants. Taconite plants are the second largest mercury emitter.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's not mine and reclamation. That's something different that deals with it.
And Mr. Chairman, another example is sulfate in the St. Louis River system and mercury methylation that is believed to result from that. So we've done work to try to document and understand that. And that is the kind of research. Also, work on figuring out how non-ferrous mine waste will behave when they're left in nature, and to try to mitigate and deal with the issues that are unique to sulfide mining will be another example of the kind of work that we're doing that we think we need to do in order to understand and permit those operations.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask another question? How this money is going to be tracked? Is it going to be put into the general fund? Is there a special revenue account?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, there is a natural resource fund that's established as part of this legislation.
And Mr. Chairman, what other monies go into that particular fund? What I want to do is to have some kind of an accounting, just in a rough little sheet of paper that I got in front of me. I can get up to $9 million, and the spreadsheet said 2, and the DNR is saying 1. It might be a nice little slush fund.
The author of the bill, Representative Loganius, wants to comment.
I am very sympathetic with having all cost expenditures by government clearly understandable by not just legislators but by the public. So if you will look online, 2.36, for an example of the language that we are using, that we require the chief financial officer, this is of PCA, but we have the same language for DNR and Bowser, to display the agency's budget on the agency's website in a manner that will allow citizens to easily understand the value they are getting for their money. We do that for each of the agencies in this bill. We have been pushing about as hard as we can to get outcomes-based budgeting for each of the agencies that are under the jurisdiction of the Environment Committee. I am more than willing to beef up this language for full disclosure, for outcome. DNR does have an outcomes-based budgeting system, a results-based budgeting system now. It is already on the website telling citizens what they get. PCA and Bowser are outcomes are lacking at this point. They do some, but I don't think citizens could understand what they're getting. But it's something I feel very strongly about. If we need to beef up this language for disclosure so that everything and every dime is how not only we know how it's spent, but how citizens understand it's spent, I'm willing to go down that road as far as you want to go.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
it's
not only that particular part of it, but if it's being spent for what it is they say it's being spent for.
I would agree.
And it says that it's being spent for mine and reclamation, but that may, all of a sudden, we have a testimony that it's all kinds of research facilities and anything else, and that is not, in my opinion, mine and reclamation monitoring.
Mr. Madness, on that point.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, on line 39.2 of the bill, it establishes the mining administration account, and the fees and money generated by this bill would be deposited into that account. And then there's an appropriation, specific appropriation to DNR from that account, and that's limited to what's in the appropriation bill. And so I guess to the point of, you know, if there's some way to monitor how much comes in and what's spent, I believe that's how that's set up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I didn't quite follow the language.
39.2, Mr. Chair, the Mining Administration account.
It's already in law. 39.18,
I guess, is what staff.
Mark, sir, I have the
endorsement,
I'm sorry.
Okay.
39.1.
Well, Mr. Chair, this also says it shall be, it may be appropriated to the commissioner. Is that by the legislature? And Mr. Mark, maybe can help me with that.
Mr. Chairman, I could answer that. And it is, Representative Solberg, it is going to be a direct appropriation. In fact, the appropriation for the first 2 years is contained on 12.19.
Okay.
And Director Gadatis is correct. The fee, the 178 on the spreadsheet, is a combination of the mining administration costs and also the costs associated with the easement changes. So really the mining is, if you look on page 12.19, the appropriation the first year is 1.202 and the second year 1.202, and that is to cover the costs associated with issuing the permit.
Issuing what permit?
Representative Rucavina. Well, Mr. Chair, we got to the permit fee every year. That's $360,000 for 60 grand because every mine company has been mining. So I'm still not tracking this money. It's at 1.8 and 1.8 on the spreadsheet. And then the $360,000 we know is going to be raised. But, you know, members, I just want to pick something here. Mr. Vadas, you mentioned in your response to Representative Solberg that you were going to be looking at non-ferrous mining, what to do. So you're asking the taconite mines that are currently operating to pay for your research and what you're going to do if there ever is a non-ferrous mine in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, there is research that is being done specifically on non-ferrous sulfide minerals, and there is some application, select application to taconite mines. But no question, you are correct, Representative Rucavina, most of that research is being done in order to enable the permitting of non-ferrous operations.
So it seems, Madam Chair, your argument to us is their DNR is being asked to, you know, look at and monitor what's going on, and that they're not paying the real cost, but now they're paying the cost for a mine that might be put in Minnesota 10 years from now. And then, and I will just end with this. I know it's late and everybody wants to get out of here, but Mr. Vadas, the DNR, and Mr. Myers, DNR is charging. They have charged the company, one company that is trying to site a non-ferrous mine, $20 million to date, I believe over 4.5 years. Am I wrong? Is it 4.5 years?
Mr. Chair, that would be for that.
4.5 years, $20 million, and the EIS still isn't done to be put out for public comment. So, yeah, it is pretty dangerous stuff, and it's all over this room. It's in that TV set. It's in that TV monitor. It's in your computer. It's in Representative Wilkie's hip. It's in somebody's heart. It's in all of that stuff I tried to cut today in my bill, those three buildings, Representative Hausman, that are being built to do research that are going to create all these jobs and pills and save the world and all of that equipment there. Where the hell do you think it comes from? The ground. I'm just saying, this is really crazy. These answers are unbelievable. This isn't to cover the cost of what they're doing now. They just said it's to cover the cost of what might happen in the future.
Mr. Vann?
The bill also does set up a fee for non-ferrous permits of mine, and also cost recovery for working on a permit. And so it is true that some of the research that's being done is for non-ferrous purposes, but the belief is eventually maybe we'll have a non-ferrous permit of mine.
Well then, Mr. Chair, and Andy, Representative Lugenia, this is not to cover the cost of what they're doing. It's to basically to pay for the department. And that's fine, but let's get it out there publicly. You can't do these things without raising taxes, and the governor has just created a new tax that he's running a department, calling it a fee, a natural resource fee or whatever it is, and that's fine. I think I made my point in reference to
Representative Solberg, we've got several people
just on a different issue. I'll even let this one go. So I feel we got more people on this issue.
You were next up. Why don't you finish up, and then attack Boris Garofalo.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have another question. On page 57 and 58, 59, there's other reports that have to be done. And rulemaking, usually rulemaking has some costs associated with it. And do we have fiscal notes on those sections as well?
If you're looking on 57, is the greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, I'm looking section 49 I know it says they may do it, but rulemaking is, I've asked agencies to do things in the past, and whenever there was any kind of a rulemaking, there was a cost associated with it. I'm asking, has there been a fiscal note requested on those?
Okay, if you would, on line 48 of the we asked the agency, and they said they could do it within the cost of line 47. So you will see that line 47 is to cover the greenhouse gas emissions part.
So, Mr. Chairman, the cost of those are $944,000, is that correct?
That is a redirection from the Environmental Fund. Yeah, I believe that's correct. It's from the Environmental Fund. And this redirection, when we asked about the greenhouse gas emissions, it said that this would be covered, line 48 essentially would be covered under line 47.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, on line 46 of your spreadsheet, you have air admission fees. Line 46 of the spreadsheet, air admission fees, is that part of this as well? Does that go into that?
$594,000. I think I'm going to ask
a
fiscal analyst to answer this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, the state statute as well as federal regulations require that the air admission fees be increased periodically to cover the increased cost. That line item is really those increased costs, not necessarily related to anything new in the bill. It's related to the general activities in the air division.
Okay, thank you.
Just let me remind the committee that with federal law and state law, air quality permits, the whole ball of wax is paid for by the permittee. That's what's different between air and water, and because there has been this long-time requirement. So when we were looking at tracking.
I give up.
Okay.
Okay.
Representative Hackworth. I'll pass. Representative Grapple. Some time ago you had a question.
Yeah,
thank you, Minister. I think we had you on the list for a long time.
Yeah, I'm afraid to ask my question, though.
Representative Houseman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative...
Representative Grapple.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius, on page 47, section 36.
Hang on for just a second.
Okay.
Yes, okay.
The yard waste prohibition...
Yes.
And I know, you know, obviously you put a lot of work into your bill, and I don't want to, attack it or anything. I'm just wondering, if you tell me the genesis of this legislation, do we really need to put this in law? Do we have a crisis in compost facilities? And if we do, and I make the mistake of having the wrong bag at a compost facility, how do people know by looking at the bag that I'm bringing that this is a... biodegradable bag versus a non-biodegradable? What's the enforcement mechanism? And why are we doing this stuff? I don't...
If I can...
Representative Wagenius.
Representative Grapple, are you from Dakota County?
Yeah.
Dakota County requires biodegradable bags for yard waste composting. Dakota and Carver, both, and some other local jurisdictions. And the reason is if you have... plastic is not biodegradable. In your waste, you have lousy compost. If you have biodegradable waste, you have compost that is valuable and usable. And so that, I think that's kind of the basic thing there. And we are blessed in this state with having new industries that do biodegradable bags. And this is, they're getting great publicity for this. And so if we are about also encouraging new industry, as well as having compost that's saleable, this is the way to go. Yeah, this is Representative Gardner's bill. This is not my bill.
Okay.
But I think the case was strongly made that this was the way to go.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I'm fortunate enough to have compost pickup at my house now, so I don't have to go out to the facility in Empire Township. But in the past, when I went there, when we showed up, they just told us, hey, don't leave your bags here, dump them out. And it seemed to work pretty good. And again, it's not that big of a deal, but it doesn't seem like this rises to the level of state statute. I just, it's an opinion. And then the second thing is, again, on page 59, standards for labeling plastic bags, and we've got a civil enforcement penalty here for a manufacturer, distributor, or wholesaler. And again, maybe I'm just misunderstanding here. Do we have an epidemic of manufacturers who are falsely claiming that they have biodegradable or degradable bags? And this is something that we need to really crack down on. And I got to tell you, I knocked on a lot of doors last fall, and no one brought this issue to my attention. No one's come to my office this session. I don't serve on the Environment Committee, though, so maybe this is a tier one issue. Can you just elaborate, please?
It's probably a tier one issue for your county waste administrator. It's probably not unless you door knock one of your county waste administrators. It's probably, you're right, it's not a tier one issue. But if the county ends up with plastic in their compost, they don't have saleable or usable compost. Now, you know, there is an exemption in Representative Gardner's bill. If you go to someplace and dump out your plastic bags, so be it. All that he is looking for is if you use plastic bags and leave them there, then they need to be biodegradable. If you take it in a cart and dump it out, good for you. If you take it in a paper bag, good for you. But for your solid waste administrator, this is a good deal. And Dakota County, actually, is one of the best.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, we're not going to start charging $60,000 to monitor these things, too, are we? Right? That's a rhetorical question.
$60,000 rider here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your patience. Representative Houseman.
I'll ask my question separately.
Okay, and Representative Sun.
Yes, well, Mr. Chairman, this was on the previous subject. I would just like to know if Representative Rukavina and Representative Solberg really believe that if we don't lower the fees to these mines, they'll move them to South Dakota where there's a more friendly business climate, or that they're going to pay their long-suffering employees one penny more?
Good thing I came back just in time to answer that question. Representative Rukavina. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, if it took 4 years, 4.5 years, and $20 million to put a business in your district, and it wasn't, or put a new building at the University of Minnesota, and it wasn't even, the EIS wasn't done, you'd be jumping up and down like a goofy little rabbit, like I am, worse than I am. And don't tell me you wouldn't.
Solberg says I would.
I think we've pretty well exhausted that topic. I don't have any more names at the desk here, so is there any more discussion? Seeing none, then we do have a couple of procedural things we need to deal with. Remember, I mentioned at the beginning meeting we would be folding Representative Hilty's bill, and this is one that we completed the discussion on the other day. So, Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair, at long last, I would move to amend the Energy Finance Omnibus Bill as amended onto House File 2123, First Committee in Grossman.
Okay, the motion is before us, and I have here, Representative Hilty, an amendment that was a technical amendment, I guess, that you needed on your bill as well.
My understanding, Mr. Chair, was that that would be appropriate once the amendment was adopted.
Okay, so we can do it either way. You have an amendment to an amendment.
I do have it to A3 amendment.
Okay, so moved, and Representative Hilty moves the A3 amendment, a technical amendment. Did you want to comment on it?
Well, no, Mr. Chair, it's just purely technical. It's just adjusting language that some numbering that needed to be adjusted because of moving.
Any discussion in on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We now have the amendment as amended before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Murphy, you have an A4 amendment.
PMA 04 amendment, Mr. Chair. I move PMA 04 amendment to amend the portions of the Cultural and Outdoor Heritage Finance Omnibus Bill onto House File 2123, the First Committee in Grossman.
And again, members, this is one that was presented the other day. For today, I guess. It's been a long day. Earlier today.
This is just a little tiny part.
That's
that
right.
I'm amending on. It has to do with the appropriation that's done by the lottery to the Natural Resources Fund for Zeus.
I just want everybody to understand.
And it transfers the Science Museum from my bill to Representative Wiggins' bill.
Okay, everybody understand what we're doing? Any discussion? And all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We now have the motion by Representative Wiggins that House File 2123, the First Committee in Grossman, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, members. And the full committee meets again at 9 a.m. on Friday, and that's going to be a very busy day for us because we're going to have several of the division reports before us. With that, meeting adjourned.